You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, more than 80,000 people are calling for the arrest and prosecution of former President Bill Clinton, alleging he violated election laws by entering multiple polling stations in Boston and other Massachusetts areas on Tuesday. You remember there was an election going on? And we'll play the final part of the multi-part series called Capitalism. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gabriel Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Miguel Gabriel Molina. And this, by the way, folks, is it. This is the last hour of the fund drive. We're doing pretty well. And we're hoping to break all records in this hour. So far, my all-time record for this drive is 6,700 in 1 hour, and I'd like to double that. It'd be amazing if we could double that. If we could haul in another 12,000, beautiful. But we're delighted to be able to offer you the Capitalism series. You can start calling right now at 1-800-439-5732. And there are many other things we will tell you about. Anything you heard, essentially, is available now. But let me just tell you this. We're going to be trying to talk with Harvey Wasserman later on in the hour, if we can make contact, about the fact that Bill Clinton made a, shall we say, quote, and I'm quoting now, a clear and knowing egregious violation of the campaign laws to swing an election in a significant way. Bill Clinton was in polling stations shaking hands inside the polling stations. His entourage, and these are in some of the poorest communities that would have been pro Bernie, Clinton tied it up. Dozens of complaints. It's unbelievable. We're going to see if the Clintons are above the law. And we're going to see if we can give you some more information about that later on in the hour in the broadcast. But first, let us play for you part six of this amazing 3-DVD, six-part series called Capitalism.
I believe that open markets and free enterprise are the best imaginable force for improving human wealth and happiness.
Je pense que les forces sociales et politiques sont les forces centrales dans la dynamique du capitalisme.
Did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism?
Is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
How would Smith see the economic world around us?
I think Keynes would have said the problem is the hole in the economy.
Hayek really wrote The Road to Serfdom as a warning.
You always have to be careful with Marx about the one-liners. You know?
Polanyi, for me, was an intellectual earthquake.
I mean, if I had to stereotype Ricardo, I would say he would look like George Soros.
Si vous retournez chez Adam Smith, Marx, Schumpeter, vous avez des embryons de mécanismes vous permettant de comprendre la crise actuelle.
We were told that capitalism is the product of big thinkers and big ideas. But is it true? How did ideas shape our lives? What is their relation to reality? Can they help us understand today's economic crisis, let alone the future of capitalism? Buried in the dunes are the remnants of the ancient civilizations of Mesopotamia and their secrets. The dawn of our economic history.
If you're looking at the origins of all of the techniques of enterprise, where was the first interest charge, the first trade contracts, the first money, prices, the first accounting, all of these were developed in a particular part of the world, Sumer in Babylonia, in what is today southern Iraq, and they were all developed by the temples and the palace.
Athens, 2012. 5,000 years later, and the most potent symbol of our current economic crisis. A city and a country in a state of shock, forced into austerity programs in exchange for loans.
After 2 or 3 years of this austerity program, that is of the shock politics, we are facing an economic disaster.
What causes civilizations to disappear and their economies to collapse? What connects modern Greece to ancient Sumer? There was one economic historian who proposed that the answers may be buried with the ruins of ancient civilizations. Economist Kari Polanyi is back in Vienna, tracing the footsteps of her father. Karl Polanyi was born in Vienna in 1886 and grew up in Budapest. He contracted typhus in the First World War and came to Vienna in 1919 as a refugee after the short-lived Hungarian Republic, which he had supported, was crushed.
My father was a journalist, and he worked for a weekly economic journal called the Österreichische Volkswirt. And of course, so there was a deadline, and the copy, he had to finish his copy, his columns, by Thursday night. And he used to smoke. And this room was, you could not see from one side of the room to the other. It was just filled with smoke.
Vienna, once the capital of an empire, was in the 1920s a politically divided city in a country struggling with economic chaos.
My father was living in a Vienna where there was massive unemployment, where there was a very strong socialist party. They say the Socialist Party of Austria was elected in Vienna from 1918 in every single election until the Civil War.
Karl Polanyi was immersed in Vienna's politics and its socialist movement.
We're going to the Karl Marx book. It was the most avant-garde social housing in all of Europe. Vienna in the 1920s, socialist Vienna, managed to turn the class relationship around. That, of course, is what upset Hayek and company, because the financing for the social housing was by taxing the private houses, the private residential houses.
In 1934, this experiment was brutally put to an end.
Civil war flares up suddenly in Austria. The government, deciding to suppress the socialists, countered a general strike by martial law. The strongholds in which the Schutzbund, or Socialist Defense League, hold out are huge blocks of flats built for the Viennese workers by the Socialist Council of the city. The strength of the buildings enables them to prolong resistance for several days, and artillery has to be brought into action against them.
It made a profound impression on me. And I think it was the formative event, I think, of my life, because I have known which side I'm on ever since.
Karl Polanyi left Vienna a year earlier, after being dismissed from his job because of his political beliefs. After the crushing of the Austrian Socialist Party, his then 10-year-old daughter Kari followed him to England. In 1944, Germany, and most of Europe are in ruins. Intellectuals like Karl Polanyi had been trying to understand the causes of the collapse of European civilization and to lay a path out of the rubble. For Karl Polanyi, it was a chain of events that began in the 19th century with the faith in the self-regulated free market.
Our thesis is that the old idea of a self-adjusting market implied a stark utopia. Such an institution could not exist for any length of time without annihilating the human and natural substance of society. It would have physically destroyed man and transformed his surroundings into a wilderness. Karl Polanyi, The Great Transformation.
Polanyi's book was translated into dozens of languages, and his ideas found an audience among the new breed of students in North America. They saw their calling in rethinking capitalism after the Second World War.
I came to the University of Chicago in the year 1950, and I suppose my generation had certain interesting goals or concerns. At the top of the list was the question, would we be back in a major depression that we had come through in the 1930s?
Beyond the facade of the skyline swept under the city's rug, teeming millions never more than a copper coin from starvation.
The second was, a new world was opening up. What about third world countries? What could we do for them?
Somewhere east of Suez, where the best is like the worst, a crowded continent swarms with people, with palaces and poverty.
What about inequality? Inequality between countries, inequality within countries. These were the cogent, the compelling issues of my generation at that time. And economics seemed on the surface to be the entry point to address these issues. But once you entered economics, you found yourself in a maze. It was an intellectual maze with no exit. Began with the basic proposition that the economic problem is scarcity in the world, that there's not enough to give everybody as much of everything as they would like. Because the world's resources were limited, they had to be allocated. The best way to allocate them, we were told, was the market economy. Were boxed into the market economy, and it was a form of intellectual alienation from the world's real issues. Economic theory was very much like a meat grinder that turns out hamburger. You put in old bread, onions, ground meat, whatever you had in the fridge, and you ground it together. And whatever else happened, it always came out hamburger. And that was the problem with economics, that wherever you began, you ended up with the market economy. Eternal, omnipresent, inescapable, and totally binding. I felt intuitively that I had to break out. I left in disappointment and despair from Chicago and went to Colombia. In Colombia, it was quite by chance that I saw a course called General Economic History from a man I had never heard of, called Carl Polanyi.
The course that Carl Polanyi taught at Columbia University was based on his own inquiry into the market economy as an ideological system, a view of society organized along the logic of the market.
And you are listening to excerpts from part six, episode six, of this amazing documentary called Capitalism. We have been featuring it on this fund drive. It is an amazing piece of documentary evidence, production gathered in 22 countries, intellectuals from around the world, economists, folks like Noam Chomsky at that level, on every aspect of capitalism. Episode one, Adam Smith, The Birth of the Free Market. Episode two, The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel. Episode three, Ricardo and Malthus, Did You Save Freedom? Episode four, What If Marx Was Right? And that sort of goes on to say, have we gotten Marx wrong by focusing on the Communist Manifesto instead of his critique of how capitalism works? A critique that is relevant and as penetrating as ever? It goes on and on. It really is. If you love history, if you want to grow your consciousness and understand a great deal more about the nature of capitalism, with extraordinary documentary evidence, and you want to help Flashpoints in this final push to establish a little bit of some funds so that we can continue to do the work. We can build this station at the base. We can fix some equipment that desperately needs to be fixed. And we can continue to do the work of Free Speech Radio. So we're in. It's it. Flashpoints has been given the responsibility to end this fund drive. It's going to end in around 44 minutes or so. And in those 44 minutes, I want to convince you, I want to urge you, I want to interest you in standing up and taking an action that nobody makes you take, but that your mind and your heart tells you it's the right thing to do. Now, you can get the Capitalism 3-DVD set, 6-part series, for a $240 contribution. There are many other things you can get. I really was very moved by the Lawrence Shoup talk, Wall Street's think tank, the Council of Foreign Relations, and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics. That was an amazing lecture by Lawrence Shoup. You can get it for a $75 contribution. You can get you can get his DVD for a $100 contribution, and you can get the book for $150. You can get all three if you want. You can get the CDs, Winter Speech Pack, 8 recent speeches, Michael Shermer, Lawrence Shoup, Kevin Powell, Ion Grillo, Lawrence Ross, Richard Wolff, Mami Abu-Jamal essays, and Jonathan Lethem. You can get that for $200. There are many combinations. You can just call 1-800-439-5732 and join us in these last few minutes in which we are tasked of bringing this marathon to a close, a successful close. I am anxious. I've set myself a high goal. I'm here with Miguel Gavila Molina, and I have committed to getting 100 of you to call. I'd like to get 100 of you to call. Now, you can call for 25 or 50 or 75. You can get any number of the premiums. You can get the DVD KPFA Super Film Pack, The Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson, She's Beautiful When She's Angry by Mary Doerr, and the 3-DVD series Capitalism. You can get those three extraordinary premiums for $420. That's right. You can get the KPFA Super Film Pack, The Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. This is a very beautiful movie about the documentary about the early life of the women's movement. Incredibly beautiful and revealing. And you can get the Capitalism, the three DVD series, all of it for $4.20. You can get the Shoup speech for $75 or $100. You can get the book for $150. Let's stand up and make a difference now. Let's get $10. $10 is fine. But I really have committed to getting 100 of you. I think we can do this, Miguel. Getting 100 of you to call 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And
we got a
match. We just got a match. We got a match. How much is that match for, Miguel?
It's for $800, and we got it from Lisa and Kim out there in the North Bay, Santa Rosa, coming through. It's huge. A lot of our listeners are up in those areas. I'd like to call out people not only from Santa Rosa, but up there from Windsor, Healdsburg, Cloverdale, all the way to the West Counties, Guerneville, Forestville, Monterrillo, Sebastopol, and down to Petaluma, around to Pen Grove, out to the town of Sonoma, Geyserville, and all the little enclaves up there. 1-800-439-5732. This is your opportunity to help us take this to another level, this marathon. 1-800-439-5732. It really costs a lot to just have this facility here, the building, the electricity, the water, the heating, the energy it takes, and then the maintenance. It's a constant struggle meeting, you know, those costs. This extra push here on Flashpoints will enable us to build a little buffer, you know, for the next marathon. And it's desperately needed. 1-800-439-5732. A lot going on. As Dennis said, there's a list full of things that you can actually acquire from your pledge.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I want to go back to playing this last part of this six-part series, Capitalism, this amazing documentary series made out of France, filmed in 22 countries, really nailing the nature of capitalism, its impact, its history, and the way the whole system works, translated perfectly for teachers, for students, for librarians, for community centers, for groups, for study groups. This is an amazing documentary series. You can get it for $240 by dialing 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. What I'm going to do, Miguel and I are going to give you back to the information in the documentary series. We're going to go into the phone room. I hope to go in there and hear the bells ringing off the hooks for people who are standing up in this final day, in these final minutes, in these final seconds of this fund drive, standing up at that last 11th hour to make that big difference, to put us really in very good shape. 1-800-439-5732. 3-DVD set, Capitalism, $240. If you've got a little extra money, this packet, the DVDs, KPFA Super Film Pack, The Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson, She's Beautiful When She's Angry by Mary Dorr, an incredible documentary, and the 3-DVD series, Capitalism. If you've got a little extra money, this would be spectacular. 1-800-439-5732. Before we go back, Miguel, you got some thank yous?
Yes, and again, every time you pledge, it becomes $2 for us. $1 becomes two, doubles, you know, your pledge. This match we received from Lisa and Kim. We just got a thing from Brandia Robinson out there from Alameda. Thank you so much for your contribution. Mara Rivera out there from San Francisco. Thank you so much. She's been a member since 1962. Orale, thank you so much to Natosi Johanna out there from Sebastopol. Thank you so much for your contribution. And again, this is the time to help us meet this match. We got an $800 match. For every dollar you contribute, it becomes two. 1-800-439-5732.
And if you've got a little, you know, we'll take 25. We need 100 callers. We'll take $25. But if you've got a little extra, if you've been holding it back, if you can give us $500 or $1,000 for a match, we can double our match here. We can make a triple match. That would be beautiful. 1-800-439-5732. And please let me hasten to remind you that you can subscribe on the web safely at kpfa.org. Hit the pledge button and you're off. We're off. Back to capitalism.
To help us get a glimpse into the future of this unfinished world of ours, there has been created for the New York World's Fair a thought-provoking exhibit of the developments ahead of us. The greater and better world...
The future of capitalism, as depicted in a General Motors-sponsored exhibit in the 1939 World's Fair. A corporate vision of freedom and human needs fulfilled by the free market.
Come, let's travel into the future. What will we see?
Firebird 2 to Control Tower. We are about to take off on the highway of tomorrow. Stand by.
It is the result of a market view of society, wrote Carl Polanyi, which equated economics with contractual relationships and contractual relationships with freedom.
The great transformation for me was an intellectual earthquake. The earth opened up. It was that kind of an amazing insight into the coming of the market economy in lockstep with the Industrial Revolution and introducing a new protagonist which had never been introduced before. Polanyi indicated in The Great Transformation that there was another player in the economy, and not simply market forces, but society itself. What he meant was that prior to modern times and the coming of the market economy, most economic transactions were under the supervision and under the rule of some social structure. Whether it was the church, whether it was the town council, or whether in tribal societies it was the norms developed from kinship and custom. He meant, therefore, that in most of history, the economy was embedded in society. Social norms had priority over economic activities.
This is how the American filmmaker D.W. Griffith imagined Babylon in his classic 1916 film, Intolerance. Babylon was one of the ancient societies that Polanyi had studied. He felt that these ruins in the desert held clues, not only to ancient civilizations, but also to how they viewed their economies.
They discovered from ancient Babylonia, that is modern Iraq, a number of tablets that were the contracts that had been made for trade from the palace to the outlying areas.
I have here five tablets which relate to ancient economy and to the economic development. This rather big tablet here is a ledger of animals available for agricultural purposes from the time of the Ur-3 period, that's at the end of the 3rd millennium BC, and it shows that the bureaucracy at the time ended up with ledger-like tablets like this, recording all kinds of economic activities.
From these clay tablets discovered in modern Iraq, people immediately concluded business is as old as mankind. And if there was a business, it meant the kind of business we knew, buying and selling, profit making, and so on.
These tablets are from a period where we think that the economy was more based on the temple and the palace and less economic activity on the private sector.
The traders were what we would call today civil servants. Their income came not from the profits on the trade. Their income came from the salaries they made. We have mistaken the nature of this trade. It is trade, but not the kind of trade that we are involved in. It was one indication that we were caught in a bind in economic history, that whenever we saw any evidence of trade, and trade is as old as mankind, we assumed business. We fell back on Adam Smith's instinctive notion that mankind has an inherent propensity to truck, barter, and exchange. In other words, put it differently, the market economy is built in as a human instinct. It was out of this kind of vice that Polanyi tried to escape.
All right. This is it, folks. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. You've been listening to excerpts from part six of the six-part 3-DVD set, Capitalism. And we are in the last minutes of this fund drive. We're asking you to stand up and make a difference, to really send us flying into this new year with a little bit of extra money. That's what we're hoping we can do now. I'm trying to get 100 of you to call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can get the 3-DVD set, Capitalism. It's a six-part series. It is quite amazing, filmed in some 22 countries, produced out of France, and really gives you a history of capitalism in which it's translated so you understand what the deal was, how it evolved, what happened. Beautiful work of documentary production. Incredible. Seriously incredible. You can get that for a $240 contribution. You can get that, Capitalism, plus the KPFA Super Film Pack. Well, that is the Super Film Pack. So you can get the Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson. She's beautiful when she's angry. Beautiful documentary, and the 3-DVD series, Capitalism. You can get it all for a $420 contribution. If you heard Larry Shute, you know his work is incredible. His investigative work is incredible. He gave a lecture recently, Wall Street's think tank, the Council of Foreign Relations, and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, and that you can get the speech for $75. You can get it as a DVD for $100. He's got a book, of course, of the same name, Wall Street's Think Tank. You can get the book for $150. You can get the CD of Shoup, a great speech about the history of the Council on Foreign Relations, deeply documented history of the Council on Foreign Relations. You can get the CD and the book for a $200 contribution. The real thing that you get, the real premium that you get, is the knowledge that you stood up, that you stood up and stepped forward, took an action that nobody makes you take, but because you wanted to support Free Speech Radio. Any dollar you give us now is doubled. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I think, Miguel, we've got some folks calling.
Yes, we do. We'd like to thank Leslie out there from Concord. Thank you so much. To Marlis Miller out there in Sebastopol, thank you for your contribution. To Veronica Delgado, thank you so much out there from, looks like, North Carolina. Orale, thank you for joining us. Out there to Peggy from Oakland, thank you for your pledge. To Colette Brooks from San Francisco, thank you for your contribution. To Victor out there from Hayward, HWD, thank you for becoming a member. And to James Hall from Los Altos, thank you for becoming a member and supporting Free Speech Radio and this particular program, Flashpoints.
Beautiful. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you, Miguel. I appreciate that. I thank all those folks from the bottom of my heart for standing up in these last few minutes and making a difference. Again, my goal, myself declared goal, is to get 100 of you to call. I think from just a guess now, we're up to about 30. We're up to about 30 people who have called so far. So that means 70 more people. That's right. It's a big job, but we can do it together. Simply standing up together and dialing 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Get the Capitalism set for $240 contribution. You can get the DVD KPFA Super Film Pack, which includes Capitalism and also the well-produced The Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson. And, I don't know, in a way, one of my favorite documentaries, and we didn't even use it on this show, but it's really beautiful, is She's Beautiful When She's Angry. And this is really the early evolution of the women's movement, produced by Mary Doerr. Beautiful. You can get all three of those incredible documentaries for $420. You can get The Shoop, as I said. You can get everything that I'm talking about here, which also includes the Winter Speech Pack, 8 recent speeches that were part of the series that is produced here, or benefits. You can get the Momi Abu Jamal essays and Jonathan Lethem. You can get all of that, everything for $550. Just say, you just call up and say, give me the KPFA Super Film Pack and Winter Speech Pack for $550, and there it is. 1-800-439-5732. We're trying to bring this fund drive to a successful and happy close. It has been a very productive fund drive, and we're trying to make these last few minutes count. This will end. This whole fund drive will end in about 27 minutes or so. 27 minutes or so. So if you, by the way, now, if you want to stand up and give us $500, $1,000, maybe somebody out there is diabolical enough to give us a $2,000 contribution. Or maybe there are 200 of you who want to give us $10, $15, $20. We will take that. That will mean a lot because there's strength in numbers. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.
Well, we're asking for your help. We've been here serving. We've been here on the air bringing you stories, bringing you interviews, information that do not make it to mainstream. Mainstream censors most of the material we cover for political and social and sometimes economic reasons. But it doesn't matter. We are Free Speech Radio. We take truth to power, and we bring you those untold stories, and we give voice to the voiceless, to those communities that are struggling for dignity, self-respect, and justice. 1-800-439-5732. The call is toll-free. The donation is tax-deductible. It's just your effort. Rather than give Uncle Sam, as we call Tio Sam, you know, the taxes, you give us that money and use it as a tax write-off. 1-800-439-5732. Be the ones that stood up with us to defend not only free speech, but to defend those struggling for justice, be it the working class, the poor, the communities of color, women, youth. 1-800-439-5732. And Flashpoints, as you know, we take it out there into the communities that are in trouble, into the communities that haven't had press coverage because it's not profitable for rag sheets, newspapers, magazines, or local media outlets. We are there because we care. 1-800-439-5732. There's less than 20 minutes. Now is the time. Do not hesitate. We need your help.
1-800-439-5732. And just to mention, Miguel, that a week from today, we're going to be out in Santa Cruz.
Yes.
At
Barrios Unidos.
And we're going to have an incredible show that's going to get into the battle against spraying pesticides near schools.
Right.
There's a new homeless union. People are fighting back.
One of the first new homeless unions out of that area, yes.
It's a revolutionary movement by homeless folks coming together. And that includes homeless folks who were, we're talking about brown people who have worked their whole life as pickers.
Right.
But there's not, you know, what do you make when you're working in the field? As you say, you end up at the end of the day, if you can't lift, you don't have a salary. What do you do? Where do you go? So there's more and more brown people who
absolutely
put the food on the table.
And a lot of times, Dennis, a lot of times people don't realize that the farm workers out there, a quarter of them, if not more, are homeless. You know, where do they live? There's no shelters.
That's right.
They live in the bush. They live in the woods, out in the elements. That's why we are going to Santa Cruz, to bring light to those communities that are struggling just to exist, struggling for their dignity and human rights. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. We'll see what's coming on. We'll make an exchange there. 1-800-439-5732. 19 minutes to go for me to get 100 of you to stand up and make a difference. You're going to have to do some work now, folks. We're going to have to do this together. We're going to have to honor that sacred pact. That's what I mean this. Believe me, I mean this from the bottom of my heart. When I say I think of it as a sacred pact where we, the producers, vow to give you an alternative. We're not going to feed you the corporate crap. Not over these airways, not at 5 to 6 every day on Flashpoints. We vowed to bring you that radical alternative, to pry that fist open on truth. And you're part of the sacred pact is that you stand up and you call 1-800-439-5732 because you believe in something and you want to support this invention called Pacifica Radio. You believe in this electronic leaflet. You believe that we deserve an alternative to the corporate press. I'm asking you to stand up now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We have about 38, 40 people who have called. That means 60 of you need to stand up right now and make a difference. Anything from $10 to $10,000, we'll take it. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. You can get the multi-part, six-part series, Capitalism. It's a three DVD set. You can get it for $240. You can get anything you heard during this fund drive. But what you get is the real open flow of information. And speaking of open flows, we were just given a $920 match from Marvin and Sherry. Thank you. And they are, I guess, challenging in part the South Bay to stand up and make a difference. So now we're in another match. $920. How fast can we make that? 1-800-439-5732. 3-2. We've got some more callers, Miguel.
Yes, we do. Sandy McCabe out there from Pengrove, out there in Sonoma County. Thank you so much.
Sandy.
From Colleen Cannery from San Jose. Thank you for becoming a member. To Anson Davalos from Los Gatos. Thank you for making the pledge contribution. And our lines are open. Countdown now here. I think we have less than 15 minutes. This is your time to take a stand. If you hesitated, or like as Dennis has been saying, if you got a little extra, get a membership for someone that's incarcerated, you know, for an inmate. Get an extra pledge for the local school library, for the local junior college, for the local college, the local vocational school. Some of this material is so relevant. People need to understand how capital works and how it has affected not just our society, but the global community. And again, our lines are open. We got plenty of operators waiting for your call. We need you to go to your phones. We need you to help us. We need your pledge as a commitment that you support Free Speech Radio and Community Public Radio, which we are. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. Any of you who heard the program yesterday about the murder of the most important indigenous community leader in Honduras, anybody who heard that knows how we do the story differently. Yeah, they did mention her name. They did do, I think it was a 90-second piece on NPR this morning. But let me tell you, this radio station is for the people. We are a power base for the people to get the word out. We honor that notion of giving a microphone to the disparaged, the disinherited, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the disrespected, the poor, those people who are being more and more marginalized by this unequal wealth gap. That's what we're about. We report for the 99%. We stand on the corners. We are at the crossroads of the protest. We are there for you, this radio station, and this show in particular. Flashpoints is on the radical cutting edge. We believe in taking community radio out to the community. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio. Mike, did you have something there? Doing well online at kpfa.org. You can call KPF, you can go online, kpfa.org. It's that you don't even really need the www. Just hit kpfa.org. You come to KPFA at 94.1. You go to the website. You see the button that says pledge. You click on, and there you are. 1-800-439-5732. Okay, Miguel, we have 13 minutes to go. 13 minutes to go. 1-800-439-5732.
And the operators, we have operators waiting for your call. We'd like to hear from more folks down in the Southern Peninsula, out there by Campbell, out there by Los Gatos, San Jose, Mountain View. We know you're out there. We're even reaching out there and folks in Santa Cruz. We have a new... The repeater line out there, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz. That's 97.5 FM. And again, you can go online too out there. We'd like to hear from folks in Santa Cruz and Salinas, Watsonville, out there by Half Moon Bay, all those areas out there. We know there's a lot of folks. We ourselves have been traveling out there into those areas, not only to Santa Cruz, to Barrios Unidos, that deals with youth and tries to bring the whole whole thing of gang warfare to an end by healing the communities affected. We're also been in Half Moon Bay covering the ongoing struggle for justice for Yadira Serrano, who was shot to death about a year and a half ago, 2 years, by a sheriff in that area. 1-800-439-5732. We'll be talking about another case that happened this week. Huge case in San Francisco with the Alex Nieto case getting justice. He is the young man that was shot 48 times by a group of police officers that wielded unnecessary, vicious, violent, excessive force. That case started this week.
It's in federal court now.
Yes.
You're going to have extensive reporting on that as well, Miguel.
Yes.
1-800-439-5732. What do we got here? Let's see. 1-800-439-5732. We made half the match. We're in a $950 match, and we made half of it. We made a little bit more than half of it, which means that we need about four or five more of you just to make that match. It's 5:49 in the afternoon. We have 10 minutes and 15 seconds left of this fun drive. I'm really anxious to see if I can get a whole bunch of you to call in these final remaining 10 minutes now to stand up and make a difference. Get the 3-DVD set, Capitalism, 6-part series, $240. You can get the KPFA Super Film Pack, which has Capitalism, also includes She's Beautiful When She's Angry and The Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson. That's the 3-DVD. That's the complete 3-film set, KPFA Super Film Pack, $420, 1-800-439-5732. Larry Shoup speech. Incredible speech. You can get it on CD for $75. Listen to your car on the way to work and learn a great deal about how the Council on Foreign Relations works. The speech is called Wall Street's Think Tank, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics. Speech $75. DVD $100. You can get the book $150. The CD and the book for $200. Whatever. Let us step forward and make a difference. We are down to 9 minutes. 9 minutes left in this fun drive. I am really hoping to get, I don't know if I can do it. I'm a little nervous, but I think we can. I think we have time. I think we have enough phone volunteers. I think we can get people to do it. 100 folks, 1-800-439-5732. 3-2, and we're going to count what comes in at kpfa.org if you pledge and donate online. 1-800-439-5732. We're trying to make the second $920 match, and it's getting a little slower. I'm thinking it should be a lot faster now. And I think, well, it looks like it's beginning to pick up now. Looks like we have about five people on the line. 1-800-439-5732. Okay, we've made that $920 match at 5:51 in the afternoon, and we're hoping that we can maybe get one more from somebody who in the last 9 minutes wants to throw us over the top. In the last 9 minutes, 1-800-439-5732. Throw down a $1,000 challenge and let's see if we can do it. 1-800-439-5732.
We've been able to meet the matches. We've been able to almost get close to our goal because you're committed, because you know that the work we do here is necessary to bring you truth, to bring you coverage that the government censors, that the corporations don't want you to know, that mainstream media can't profit from. That's what we do. We give coverage to those untold stories, untold issues, and voice to persons and communities that would not have a voice if it wasn't for Free Speech Radio.
Well, here we are now. 7 minutes to go. 7 minutes to go. I think we have over somewhere around 55 people who have already called, and that's beautiful. But I'm going for that 100. We've got 8 minutes to do it. 8 minutes to do it. I'm trying to get 100 of you to stand up in these last few minutes of the fund drive to help us build this powerful electronic leaflet at the base, to help strengthen the base, to help us make sure that our infrastructure is powerful so that this electronic leaflet, your powerful alternative free speech network and your radio station, KPFA, founded some 67 years ago by folks who were willing to go to jail to resist war, who understood how important it was to have an independent media. And here we are, the stewards of this media. We're still holding on because of you. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, please stand up now and make a difference in the North Bay, South Bay, East Bay, or in the Bay. Maybe you're on a boat. 1-800-439-5732. You got, what do you got there?
We got another pledge here. We'd like to thank Peter Bassell out there from Soquel, California. Thank you for your contribution. And yes, this show is the real thing. That's because the voice and the force behind it makes it all come into reality to support and to bring justice to the communities that so desperately have been marginalized by corporations, the military, and the government. 1-800-439-5732. We're down to, what, 6-7 minutes left here? This is the time to stand up. If you've hesitated, if you have, you know, thought about it, well, maybe, or if you've never helped support Free Speech Radio, this is the time. And, oh, yes, Dennis, we just got another match.
All right. All right, this one's for $620. Thanks, Kim. Thanks, Kevin. 5:54 and 55 seconds. About 5 minutes left to go to this entire fund drive. We got another match. How about pulling out the stops for Free Speech Radio? Again, 1-800-439-5732. Get anything you heard over the last couple of weeks. You can get the Capitalism 6-part series for $240 contribution by dialing 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're down to 3.5 minutes left in this entire fund drive. Why don't you be a part of the last 10 people who call now and help us make this match, doubling the contribution that you give us. If you get the Capitalism 6-part series for a $240 contribution, you're giving us almost $500. If you want the DVDs, KPFA Super Film Pack, with the Capitalism, with the Black Panthers by Stanley Nelson, and with the incredibly beautiful She's Beautiful When She's Angry by Mary Doerr, incredibly moving documentary about the early women's liberation movement. You can get all three of those for $420. We're down to 3 minutes. 1-800-439-5732. Every dollar that you give us now is doubled. Pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio. Stand up and make a difference. Step forward. Say yes. Put your money where your beliefs are. Support this electronic leaflet and celebrate the First Amendment. 1-800-439-5732. We have to deal with folks like Trump. We must be able to be strong to take on somebody who is fanning the flames of fascism. Have you seen the pictures of Trump supporters at rallies while Trump is talking, attacking and dragging black people and brown people out, kicking them, punching them, and these Trump supporters never getting arrested? It's outrageous. It's outrageous. That's our job. We need this network to do that. We will stand against the Klan. We will stand strong against white supremacy. We're asking you to stand up now and stand strong for Free Speech Radio. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 5732. 2 minutes to go. 2 minutes, Miguel. Just 2 minutes. 1-800-439-5732. 2 minutes.
You know, if those 2 minutes, someone out there had the means to get the combo, the KPFA Super Film Pack and Winter Speech Pack for $550, that would reach this goal. Who can it be now? Who has a little extra
90 seconds
that wants to keep the last remaining network of free speech radio alive in the United States?
We're in
a
match.
Who will be that? This is the match. Don't hesitate. It's a tax write-off. It's a free phone call. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. It doesn't cost you anything outside of you pushing those buttons. 1-800-439-5732. It's now or never. We need you to step up to your phone and make a pledge. It can be $25, $50, or $550 for the Super Film Pack and Winter Speech Pack.
All right, we made that match. Now we have 1 minute, Miguel. 1 minute to get 100 people to, I think we've got to be around 70. 1 minute. If you all stood up now who was listening, call 25, 50, 75, get the free speech pack, whatever you wanted to do, we could do it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll catch the second half of Temujin Duran's new film, Obey. And before that, some disobedient thoughts about Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. As I'm speaking, the United States has not yet started raining bombs down on Damascus. By the time you hear this, the smell of charred flesh may already be in the air. Don't worry, you won't have to smell it. And you won't be shown any graphic photos of dead children on the TV news either. That might upset you. All you have to do is pay for it, and not interfere with the appetite for death and destruction that our rulers seem to feel so strongly. Just keep calm, carry on, don't interfere, and you'll be fine. Let's start with a nice essay from the Times of India, August 29. I've condensed it a bit for radio. It's by Chittanand Rajgata, and it's titled, Why America Cannot Live Without Wars. Here goes. On the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, the United States is poised to unleash another nightmare some 10,000 kilometers away in the Middle East. Washington's war machine is geared up to strike Syria because Damascus allegedly used chemical weapons against its own population. Never mind that many regimes worldwide inflict atrocities against their own people by other means. The president came to office on the strength of his anti-war credentials, especially on opposing the phony war foisted on Iraq. But he is now running with the war hounds. And the rest of the Washington establishment is chomping at the bit to unleash missiles on Syria. Apparently, America cannot live without a war. On August 27, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel indicated that the U.S. was ready to go. This when a U.N. team is still investigating the reported use of chemical weapons in the conflict between the regime of Bashar al-Assad and the rebels. The U.S. told the U.N. team to pack up and get out of the way. just as the U.S. did before its descent into the Iraq War. Despite the appalling intelligence failures during previous such conflicts, U.S. officials placed immense faith in their own findings, while scoffing at international efforts. "I think the intelligence will conclude that the Syria government was responsible," Hagel said. If all this recalls the war against Iraq not too long ago, not many in Washington seem keen on remembering it. Instead, they are claiming that this time is completely different, and we will have a short surgical strike, not really a war. But America's discerning have long recognized that the country can never live without war. It is a country made for war. By one count, the United States has fought some 70 wars since its birth 234 years ago, at least 10 of them major conflicts. "We like war. We're good at it," the great insightful comedian George Carlin said some 2 decades ago, during the first Gulf War. "We're not good at anything else anymore. Can't build a decent car or a television, can't give good education to the kids or health care to the old, but we can bomb the b- out of any country." Similar sentiments have been echoed more recently. During the Iraq War, business pundit Paul Farrell wrote, quote, "America's economy is a war economy, not a manufacturing economy, not an agricultural economy, nor a service economy, not even a consumer economy. Deep inside, we love war. We want war, need it, relish it, thrive on war. War is in our genes, deep in our DNA. War excites our economic brain. War drives our entrepreneurial spirit. War thrills the American soul. Oh, just admit it, we have a love affair with war." Unquote. And so, America will be off to another war shortly. Thus ends Chidanand Rajgata, noted journalist and editor from India. One sidebar comment here. He quotes business columnist Paul Farrell. "We love war. We want war. Need it. Relish it." That's not quite true. The American people do not love, need, or want war. It's the American establishment that loves, needs, and wants war. Wall Street and big business love, need, and want war. The national security state loves, needs, and wants war. Our political class that serves the economic power loves, needs, and wants war. The 99% does not. Before almost every war that the United States has started or joined in, the people have opposed going to war. That is true of our Libya war, our Iraq war, Gulf War I, the Vietnam War, and especially World War I. Look at the public opinion polls. By a large majority, the American people do not want a war with Syria. It's our so-called leaders that always want to start new wars, not the people. We keep electing politicians who promise to keep us out of a war or to end the war that's going on. Once elected, they each double-cross us and plunge us deeper into war. Woodrow Wilson did that in 1914. In my lifetime, Lyndon Johnson did that, then Richard Nixon, most recently Barack H. Obama. All ran for office as the peace candidate. All betrayed the voters the minute they took office. Or in Wilson's case, the minute he was re-elected. Because the president serves the power elite and the financial elite. The president serves the 1%. He does not serve the 99%. And the Congress does too, to say nothing of the Supreme Court. Which brings us back to Temujin Duran's film Obey. It's a reading from Chris Hedges' excellent book, Death of the Liberal Class. In part two today, Hedges describes what happens when corporations control the government, and what will happen in the near future. They are now having a reign of so-called inverted totalitarianism. That's a phrase from political scientist Sheldon Wallin. As the economy and the environment collapse, this will change into more classical totalitarianism. It's a dystopian vision, to be sure, but it rings true to me. Hedges ends by insisting on the need to rebel, and showing why the rebellion must be nonviolent. Well, it worked in India and in parts of Eastern Europe. Maybe it can work here. Here is more of Temujin Duran's Obey.
Ordinary citizens will increasingly suffer, and people will get scared. They will want to live their lives, raise their children, and be happy. But this will not be possible. Standards of living will go down, and unemployment will skyrocket. It will lead to random shootings and suicides. Acts of domestic terrorism will become commonplace, and the state will erode yet more civil liberties to control mass protests. Many will retreat into the dead talk of policy and analysis. Or worse, the far right, the BNP, the EDL, the Tea Party protesters, the myopic supporters of Sarah Palin, the veterans signing up for Oath Keepers, and the myriad groups of armed patriots will bring into their ranks legions of dispossessed workers, angry libertarians, and many others who until now were never politically active. The attraction of the right wing and the war makers will be that they appear to have the courage of their convictions. And it will not be right-wing parties that gain support, but far-right wingers who will sweep the polls. Eventually, it will only be a matter of time before an honest, charismatic figure arises, and people's frustration and disillusionment, their justified anger, and the absence of any coherent response will lead them to this person. All he or she need believe is that there is an enemy, someone to blame. These movements will eventually mutate into full-blown fascist movements. We will be told that we have to defend ourselves and the honor of the nation. Military force will be exalted and people will be beaten up. They will begin to advocate violence. The deterioration of political systems will generate resentment. The resentment against the disenchanted secular world will find deliverance in the ecstatic escape of unreason. Societies that do not reincorporate the unemployed and the poor into the economy, giving them jobs and relief from crippling debt, become subject to the hysterical mass quest for ecstatic deliverance in the absurd. The emerging racism and violence that roams about the edges of society will leap into a full-blown inferno. The hatred of radical Islam will transform itself into hatred for Muslims. The hatred for undocumented workers in states such as Arizona will soon become hatred for Mexicans and Central Americans. The hatred by those defined as American patriots, a largely white mass movement, will become a hatred for African Americans. The hatred for liberals will morph into the hatred for all democratic institutions, from universities and government agencies to cultural institutions and the liberal media. They will see themselves and the values they support swept aside. Due to the lack of any articulated alternative, in a time of financial and environmental collapse, the way is cleared for military values of hyper-masculinity, blind obedience and violence. This cruelty runs like an electric current through reality television and trash talk programs, where contestants endure pain and humiliation while they betray and manipulate those around them in a ruthless world of competition. These are the values championed by an increasingly militarized society and the manipulation and dishonesty in the financial sector. Friendship, trust, solidarity, honesty, and compassion are banished to the unadulterated world of competition. It is the militarization of the everyday. Economic and ecological collapse will hurt everyone, except, of course, the corporate elite, who will seek only financial gain amongst the collapse. As a result, human misery will be compounded. Indeed, it will be viewed as a source of profit. Corporations will continue in their attempt to buy and control the world's supply of clean water, and seed prices controlled by corporate seed companies will skyrocket. All essential elements for existence will offer corporations the potential for profit. And the demand for capitalist expansion, in a time of growing scarcity and environmental collapse, means that we will endure harsher forms of abuse and repression. Eventually, we will try to bring the system to its knees, but we will realize ourselves as political beings too late. We will understand too late the dynamics of capitalism and human evil. We will realize too slowly that we must challenge every level of management, We will call for sweeping social transformations, and for this we will be destroyed. As communities fragment under the weight of internal chaos and increasingly dramatic changes caused by global warming and economic despair, they will face a difficult choice. We can openly resist or retreat into a pure survivalist mode, a form of primitive tribalism. But this retreat will leave participants as morally and spiritually bankrupt as the corporate forces arrayed against them. And the elites that successfully convinced us that we no longer possess the capacity to understand the truth or to fight back against the chaos caused by economic and environmental catastrophe will use their resources to create privileged little islands where they will have access to the security and goods denied to the rest of us. The masses may periodically strike out with blind fury against increased state repression, widespread poverty, and food shortages, but they will lack the ability and self-confidence to challenge in big and small ways the structures of control. The fantasy of a widespread popular revolt is just that, a fantasy. Many will also naively believe that it can be countered with physical resistance and violence. But violence has inherent problems. Those who prove themselves most adept at defending societies under siege come from the criminal class. Violence is a drug. Those most addicted to violence are those who have the access to weapons and a hunger for force. And killers rise to the surface of all armed movements, even those that could be defined as just, and contaminate them with the intoxicating and seductive power that comes with the capacity to kill and destroy. You pit monster against monster, and the sensitive, the humane, and the gentle, those with a propensity to nurture and protect life, are pushed aside and often murdered. It is a romantic vision of war and violence that is put forth by mainstream culture. Those who resist with force cannot hope to defeat the corporate state. They will not keep alive the cultural values that must be sustained if we are to have a future worth living. Armed resistant movements are always mutations of the violence that spawned them. Sometimes it is, of course, unavoidable, but violent response to repression, whether it achieves its goals or not, is counterproductive. Violence must be avoided, although finally not at the expense of our own survival. Perhaps we'll continue to believe in change and real democracy. Yet democracy, a system to challenge the status quo, has been corrupted to serve the status quo. We will be left with nowhere to turn and instead choose inaction. The idea that we can always make more money, meet new quotas, consume more products and advance our careers, this idea that human and personal progress is somehow inevitable, leads to political passivity. Our passivity is due in part to our inability to confront the awful fact of extinction, either our own inevitable mortality or that of the human species. The emotional cost of confronting death is painful, and we prefer illusion. The election and re-election of Obama was one more triumph of illusion over substance. It was skillful manipulation and betrayal of the public by the corporate power elite. We mistook style and ethnicity for progressive politics and genuine change. The goal of a branded Obama, as with all brands, was to make passive consumers mistake a brand for an experience. And this is why Obama was named Advertising Age's Marketeer of the Year for 2008. Passivity permits societies to transfer their emotional allegiance to the absurd and ignore real problems. It exacerbates despair. It keeps us in a state of mass self-delusion. Once we are drawn into this form of magical thinking, the structure and goals of the corporate state are not questioned. This magical thinking, coupled with its bizarre ideology of limitless progress, holds out the promise of an impossible, unachievable happiness. It has turned whole nations into self-consuming machines of death. Once credit dries up for the average citizen, once massive joblessness creates a permanent and enraged underclass, once the cheap manufactured goods that are the opiates of our commodity culture vanish, we will evolve into a system that closely resembles classical totalitarianism. Cruder and more violent forms of repression will be employed as the softer mechanisms of control favored by inverted totalitarianism prove useless. The huge bureaucracy that sustained the empire will cease to function as communities collapse into localized enclaves. The great monuments of capitalism, like the abandoned temples of past civilizations, will stand as deserted relics of a lost age as the world alters drastically around them. Some of us will build small, self-contained structures, ones that do as little harm as possible to the environment, and try to weather the collapse. Those who survive will need isolated areas of farmland distant from urban areas. The cities will be like deserts, and violence will spread out across the urban landscape as produce and goods become prohibitively expensive and state repression becomes harsher and harsher. The giddy, money-drenched, choreographed carnival, the petty spectacle of politics, will divert our attention from the collapsing world around us. The glitz and propaganda, the ridiculous obsessions imparted by our electronic hallucinations, and the spectacles that pass for political participation will mask the deadly ecological assault by the corporate state. We will convince ourselves that global warming never existed, or we will concede that it exists but insist we can adapt. Both responses will satisfy our mania for eternal optimism and our huge reckless pursuit of personal comfort. And all around us, the natural world will change. High in the Arctic, the summer sea ice will disappear. The dark water that remains absorbing more solar radiation than reflective white ice, significantly increasing the rate of global warming. The Siberian permafrost will disappear, sending up plumes of methane gas from the underground. The Greenland ice sheet and the Himalayan Tibetan glaciers will melt. All remaining nations and corporations will make a rush for the polar regions. Huge fishing trawlers will rip up the seafloor and kill corals, bryozoans, tube worms, and other species that nurture new schools of fish. They will leave behind barren underwater wastelands of mud and debris. Forests will be cut down incessantly for fuel and commodity. Water will become contaminated. Air will become saturated with carbon emissions. Soil will be depleted. Acidity levels in the oceans will skyrocket. Atmospheric temperatures will soar. We will push the other animals we share this planet with towards extinction. The Earth will become ecologically impoverished. And someone, somewhere, will make obscene sums of money from it. Corporations, indifferent to what is sacred, will see the death of the planet as just another investment opportunity. They will scurry to mine the exposed polar waters for the last vestiges of oil, gas, minerals, and fish. And these very corporations will dictate our relationship to the ecosystem on which we depend for life, ruling out all chance of survival. The final phase of 5,000 years of settled human activity ends with collective insanity. One of the only coherent philosophical positions is revolt. It is a constant confrontation between man and his obscurity. It is not aspiration, for it is devoid of hope. We cannot influence fate. We will all die and our individual beings will be obliterated. But we have a choice in how we live. A living man can be enslaved and reduced to the historic condition of an object. But if he dies in refusing to be enslaved, he reaffirms the existence of another kind of human nature. The corporate elite does not argue that the current system is just or good, because it cannot. But it has convinced the majority of citizens that there is no alternative. But we are not slaves. We have a choice. We have the moral capacity to refuse to be either a victim or an executioner. We have the moral capacity to say no, to refuse to cooperate. Any boycott or demonstration, any occupation or sit-in, any strike, any act of obstruction or sabotage, any refusal to pay taxes, any fast, any popular movement, and any act of civil disobedience ignites the soul of the rebel and exposes the dead hand of authority. But we can no longer seek to reform a broken system. Let the empire collapse. Sometimes we must die to be reborn, and if it's broken, break it in half. We can march in Copenhagen. We can join the International Day of Climate Action and its worldwide climate protests. We can compost in our backyards and hang our laundry out to dry. We can write letters to our elected officials. We can vote for Obama and chant, "Yes, we can." But the corporate power elite is no longer concerned with our aspirations. Real changes for society do not and cannot start at the top where the power elites reside. Those who hold power will not act with the urgency required to protect human life and the ecosystem. Decisions about the fate of the planet and human civilization are in the hands of moral and intellectual ogres. These political and corporate masters are driven by a craven desire to accumulate wealth at the expense of human life. The leaders of these corporations now determine our fate. They are not endowed with human decency or compassion, yet their lobbyists make the laws. Their public relations firms craft the propaganda and trivia pumped out through systems of mass communication. Their money determines elections. Their greed turns workers into global serfs and our planet into a wasteland. As climate change advances, we will face a choice between obeying the rules put in place by these corporations and rebellion. Those who work human beings to death in overcrowded factories in China and turn the Gulf of Mexico into a dead zone are the enemy. They serve systems of death. We cannot appeal to their better nature. They have none. We will either defy the corporate elite, which will mean civil disobedience, a rejection of traditional politics for a new radicalism, and the systematic breaking of laws, or see ourselves consumed. The future, if we obey, will be wrested from us. Acts of resistance are moral acts. They take place because people of conscience understand the moral rather than the practical imperative of rebellion. They should be carried out not because they are effective, but because they are right. Those who begin these acts are always a few, but no act of resistance is useless, whether it is refusing to pay taxes, fighting for a Tobin tax, revoking a corporate charter, holding global internet votes, or using Twitter to catalyze a chain reaction of refusal against the capitalist machine. The internet has been the latest technological instrument of control, but technology is morally neutral. It serves the interests of those who control it, and those who control it today are destroying journalism, culture, and art, while they herd the population into clans that fuel isolation, self-delusion, intolerance, and hatred. We must trust that resistance is worthwhile. The media, the arts, scholarship, and political and social movements must become conduits for unvarnished moral outrage and passion. We must defy systems and even laws that permit corporations to strangle our culture, but they will hate us for it. All who speak in a moral voice, one tied to facts rather than illusions, will become freaks. A culture, once it no longer values truth and beauty, condemns its most creative and moral people to poverty and obscurity. And this is our destiny. The corporate elite will label us the enemy. They will condemn the rebel as impractical. They will dismiss the stance as counterproductive. They will chastise the rebel for being angry. They will use the hypocritical language of compromise, generosity, and understanding to argue that we must accept and work with the current systems of power. But the rebel is not concerned with self-promotion or public opinion. The rebel knows that, as Augustine wrote, hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and the courage to change them. This defiance, this capacity to say no, is what mass culture and mass propaganda seeks to eradicate. As long as we are willing to defy these forces, we have a chance. If not for ourselves, then at least for those who follow. Acts of rebellion permit us to be free and independent human beings. But rebellion is not the same as revolution. Revolution works towards the establishment of a new power structure, and we cannot repeat the mistake of revolution. Rebellion is about perpetual revolt and permanent alienation from power. And it is only in a state of rebellion that we can hold fast to moral imperatives that prevent a descent into tyranny.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart,
but you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Hope is a word that is applicable only to those who grasp reality, however bleak, and do something meaningful to fight back, which does not include the farce of elections and the involvement in mainstream political parties. Hope is about fighting against the real forces of destruction, not chanting "Yes, we can" in rallies orchestrated by marketing experts, or just begging Obama to be Obama. Hope in the hands of realists spreads fear into the black heart of the corporate elite. But hope, real hope, will remain thwarted by a collective self-delusion unless we choose it to be otherwise. We will either obey or rebel.
And that's all for New World Notes for this week. Thank you for listening. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Yost advising, illegitimae non carborundum, keep calm, and remember, war is not healthy for democracy and other living things. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The UN Security Council Thursday was urged by UN Humanitarian Coordinator Stephen O'Brien to encourage the warring sides in Yemen to return to the bargaining table. Fighting between Yemeni forces and a Saudi-led group seeking to reinstall former President Abdurrabah Mansour Hadi has killed more than 6,000 civilians, most of those victims of Saudi air attacks, which have been pounding the country on a daily basis for the past year. Hadi, running unopposed, was elected to a 2-year transitional term in February 2012. Although his term formally ended in March 2014, he held on to power until February of the following year, when protesters surrounded the presidential palace, holding him under virtual house arrest. He resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia. Once there, he rescinded his resignation and declared himself still president. He was recognized shortly thereafter by Riyadh. Despite the fact that in 2012 his candidacy was backed by the ruling party as well as the parliamentary opposition, last year Hadi's own party, the General People's Congress, said that they would not accept his return to the presidency. The Saudis began bombing a few days after that announcement. Peace talks were due to resume this past January, but the Saudis refused to meet and a new date has not yet been set. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
Civilians in Yemen face daily relentless and indiscriminate shelling and bombing, according to Mr. O'Brien. The humanitarian chief said more than 2,000 children have been killed since the start of the conflict. 90 have been killed so far this year alone. He spoke to the Security Council via video conference from Brussels.
Once again, I underscore the urgent need for this council and the international community more broadly to impress upon the parties to this conflict their obligations to take greater measures to protect civilians, to facilitate unconditional and sustained access to all parts of Yemen. And I also ask the council to press the parties to resume peace talks and agree to a cessation of hostilities.
Mr. O'Brien said the UN and its partners continue to support millions of desperate citizens despite challenges. Last month, over 3 million Yemenis received food assistance, nearly half of a million more than in January. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
This month's president of the Security Council, Ismael Gaspar Martins, who is the permanent representative of the Republic of Angola, spoke with journalists following the closed session.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I think we can talk. Let me say that, as you have seen, the council has just ended its deliberations on Yemen. The council expressed a very grave concern about the dire situation and called for allowing in unimpeded work of the humanitarian agencies. This was our main focus, the humanitarian situation, which is extremely grave in Yemen, and the call on the member states to respond to humanitarian appeal, called on the sides to comply with international humanitarian law, expressed grave concern about the increased activity of ISIL and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. We reaffirmed full support to the work of the special envoy of the Secretary General, Ismail Olcheikh Ahmed, who is doing a marvelous work under very difficult circumstances and making progress. We reiterate that there is no military solution to the conflict and stress that a speedy cessation of hostilities, which would allow to improve the humanitarian situation and help advance the political process. Without this, we would not be able to really deal with the grave humanitarian situation. So cessation of hostilities, it's a must. And called for a speedy resumption of the talks between the parties towards comprehensive settlement of the conflict. So basically, these are the messages that we can convey to you coming from the Council. The Council is united on this. If it were a resolution, it would be again adopted as a unanimous, because this is a unanimous position and firm position by the Council members. I can now take a few questions. I'm ready.
During the session, have there been any discussion about a draft a resolution for a humanitarian situation in Yemen? And in your view, do you think it's necessary to have such a resolution about Yemen?
With the situation which is prevailing in Yemen, yes, a resolution might be a necessity, maybe even speedy one, because the situation is evolving towards a very drastic one, with the bombings continuing on hospitals, killing children in schools. So it's a dire situation, and we cannot remain blind to a situation which is evolving before our eyes as a very dire situation.
Ambassador, you talked about a speedy resolution. Was there any timeline given for when you'd start to move forward? And also, did the special envoy give a date for when he'd like to resume talks? Last time he was here, he said he hoped for talks by mid-March. Is that still possible?
Yes, we discussed this. The talks will be coming soon. I think he's making all the necessary preparations on the consultation that he is undertaking with the countries involved also in the Gulf. And I think sooner than later we should see that resumption coming of the talks.
So yes. When will you be moving forward?
The humanitarian resolution, let me say that we discussed this already last month. It was discussed again today, as you see, right second day of our presidency. This is on the table. So I think this is also a product that should be coming soon as we finalize our negotiations.
Mr.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I just wanted to first clarify what Whitney asked about the possible timetable for a resumption of talks? Was the special envoy still talking about mid-March as a target date? And you also said that you expressed serious concern about the increasing spread of the Islamic State group. Did he give any examples about whether it's spread, how far it's spreading, how much of the country is now controlled, and what was the council's reaction? Because we hear that the control by the Islamic State is really spreading quite dramatically.
Well, I cannot give you a specific indication as to the size of the area controlled by the Islamic State, but it's a growing spread, fast also, given the inexistence of a real governmental institution, where you have a vacuum that is occupied by someone, and they are exploiting that vacuum, which unfortunately exists in the country. This is why it is important for the negotiations to start, where the parties can agree on the governance that is needed to avoid the continuing existence of a vacuum, which is again is producing this. It's growing. It's a real concern, the Islamic State. The problem is that this is in a region where there is already a situation which is of a concern to the council. So that's all I can say. Please.
Thank you. My question will be about Palestine.
About?
Palestine.
The Caliphate.
Palestine?
Palestine. Yeah. Oh, please, okay.
Yeah, the Security Council is engaged in discussing humanitarian issues in Syria, Libya, Central African Republic, Iraq. But the Security Council seems to be ignoring another humanitarian disaster in Gaza, which has been under siege for 8 years. Yeah. Do you have any initiative? Would you consider holding a special session to talk about the humanitarian situation in Gaza in particular?
All right. I fully sympathize with what you're saying. We did not discuss this morning, but the situation of Palestine, in Palestine, the humanitarian situation in Palestine, as you know, is on the agenda of the Council. So in the Council, and the Council is free to look at it at any time, which might also be done sometime during the month of March. But we did not discuss it this morning specifically. Thank you.
Can you specify on the humanitarian resolution? I'm not sure I understand what the humanitarian resolution would say going beyond what has been said from the Security Council on that issue.
Well, one of the key problems with the humanitarian situation, and this is also coming sooner, is the targeting of healthcare, be it civil society or international, which is again rendering the situation much more difficult than it should have been. So the resolution will deal with this, will deal also with the necessity for the international community to respond more effectively to the very growing dire situation and needs. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Undersecretary General O'Brien had said that there was a ship that was diverted by Saudi Arabia into Saudi Arabia, that the ship was released, but still the humanitarian IT equipment is going to be released, and he said he's pleased. I wanted to know whether the council discussed this practice of, in terms of, we're talking about sieges in other places, of blocking humanitarian aid and especially keeping this equipment behind, and whether there's any sense of the council that it shouldn't happen again. Is it normal to keep it back? And I guess that's my question.
Okay. Well, we did not talk specifically about this instance that you are mentioning, but we have discussed the need for clarity as to the possibility of keeping Djibouti and the port as the center, and for an agreement to be reached with all the stakeholders as to where the ships should come, who should decide on whether what they are bringing is needed, and move all those goods or whatever, especially if it is food and medication, to the needed population. I think I've covered all the points. Thank you very much. Thank you. Merci.
With Republicans and Democrats wrangling for position for the November election, and with the constituencies of the various candidates duking it out in social media, one issue that's not being discussed very much is the possibility of the election being stolen with rigged ballot boxes. For more on that, we spoke with an expert, Harvey Wasserman, via telephone Thursday. Harvey Wasserman, welcome back. It's a pleasure, as always.
Don, it's an honor.
You point out in the midst of all the other wrangling about these elections that the vote's probably not being counted right either. You want to talk about that some?
Well, it puts down to this. There is no verifiability of the electronic vote count. It's as simple as that. About 80% of the votes in the coming presidential election of 2016 will be cast on electronic voting machines across the United States. Now, these voting machines were mostly bought with money from the Help America Vote Act, which was passed in 2002 as a response to the fiasco in Florida in 2000. But as a result of that, most of the machines in the United States on which people will be casting ballots are 10 years old. I don't know how many of your listeners are working on computers that are 10 years old, but, they're all completely obsolete. And because they're electronic and they're privately owned, and the courts have ruled that the software is proprietary, there is no real way to verify the electronic vote count. Now, people want to come at you and say this is a conspiracy theory. Just ask them, okay, how do we verify the vote count? And you will get a blank stare because it can't be done.
Right. And you know what's interesting about it? When they're arguing exactly the opposite against Apple right now for the right to crack their technology.
Yes. And, it's an outrage. And I will tell you, Don, that I'm a Green. I'm in the Green Party, so I'm not partisan interest in the Democrats or Republicans. But the reality is that the Republicans in this coming election have the governor and the secretary of state in six key swing states where the election could be decided at midnight on election night with the governor, the secretary of state, and an IT person. And they could flip these entire states in 60 seconds or less, no matter how the people voted. And we're talking about Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, and Arizona. All six of those states have a Republican governor and a Republican secretary of state with the vast majority of votes being cast on electronic voting machines. There's absolutely nothing to stop them from flipping those states, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning on election night. The modus operandi usually is, the votes are coming in and the networks are panting and everybody's going crazy. And then all of a sudden, there's a glitch. They announce a glitch and there's a stop in the flow of information. And then a couple hours later, we emerge with a different winner. This is exactly what happened in 2004 in Ohio. And it's happened in many Senate and governor races since. And it happened to us in the we had a marijuana referendum in Ohio that we believe was flipped. So this is the flip part of the strip and flip election of 2016.
Well, what's interesting about that, I remember 2004, Kerry was going to challenge it if it happened with 95 lawyers, and then he sat on his hands and all of that. And the Greens, you guys had to bring a lawsuit, actually, and, to try to just get some public view of what actually happened. But even assuming, say, the Democrats decide to challenge this stuff aggressively, is a wherewithal all there, legally and, in terms of IT, to reconstruct the actual voting?
No, there's nothing they can do. It's you know, it's all electronic. It's all in a black box. They can't get access to the software. Let me tell you, Don, in 2004, the state of Ohio denied me my absentee ballot. I lived in the same house since 1986, for God's sakes. Voted in the same place. They wouldn't give me an absentee ballot. So I joined in the class action lawsuit, the King Lincoln Bonsall lawsuit, which Bob Fitrakis was the lead attorney, my co-author, right, on our upcoming book. And we won, for God's sakes. We won in federal court. And the federal judge, Algernon Marbley, ruled that the 88 counties in Ohio were required by federal law to produce all the records from all the voting in the 2004 election. By then, we had a Democratic Secretary of State, Jennifer Pruner, and she set up a repository in Columbus ready to receive all these materials. And when time came, 56 of the 88 counties in Ohio said they had nothing to bring. They did not have their records. One county said that it got mistakenly put in the recycling. One county said that a coffee urn spilled on the Scantron ballots. It was ridiculous. So there was never a recount, an independent recount done in 2004, which we know was stolen. And John Kerry, as you mentioned, had an army of lawyers, $7 million. We informed his people, we knew his people in Columbus, that Bush was allegedly winning by about 130,000 votes. It eventually turned into 118,775. But at the time, on election morning, the morning after the election, we made it clear to Kerry's people that 250,000 votes were still uncounted. Mm. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he conceded. Jeez. He had $7 million. He had an army of lawyers, and he went windsurfing. Mm. And he's never said a word since.
So you can expect the same sort of behavior now. In addition to that, you have interesting primary contradictions, you know, the contradictions between some of the candidates, the two candidates with mass movements of one kind or another behind them, and the leadership of each of the two political parties. So the entire apparatus for protecting the integrity of the vote or the incentive to corrupt the vote or miscount the vote, it's in a very strange place right now.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Bernie Sanders won the caucuses in Iowa and Nevada. They're totally rigged. I mean, I've talked to people who were there. It was ridiculous the way they did the voting. I don't believe Hillary Clinton won those caucuses in any way, shape, or form. And if Bernie had come out with victories in those two caucuses, the picture of the race would be much, much different. So there is no doubt in my mind that they are stealing it from Bernie. And, you know, that's what the Clintons do. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, it was very funny. There were rumors, there were reports from Texas in this last Republican primary that votes were flipping. People who were voting for Trump, their votes turned up for Rubio.
Right.
But, you know, that would be funny. We enjoy that kind of thing.
The other interesting thing about it is looking beyond the out to the conventions, beyond the actual voting, you have had this, you know, you have this massive discontent in the electorate right now, whether it leans left, right, like a totally inchoate ideological thing going on, like nothing. All kinds of individualized ideologies, maybe, and candidates that are, you know, coming out of those, out of that condition, two of them, Sanders and Trump, and the party apparatus looking to push both of them out. What do you think will happen to those groups if they're locked out of the electoral process by what appears to be developing?
Well, Don, the strategy is pretty clear. The center, the two establishments, which I guess Mitt Romney's getting in today or is going to do something today.
Yeah.
And Hillary, of course, you know, represents the corporate Democrats. You know, they are terrified of Bush on the right. Trump on the right and Bernie on the left. And I think that Bernie has a pretty coherent message. Mm-hmm. Trump is a traditional fascist strongman. I mean, he's like Mussolini, not quite as bad as Hitler, but very similar to Mussolini in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about him. And Berlusconi also in Italy, similar to him.
Yeah.
Big money and big ego.
Yeah.
Bernie, I think, delivers a pretty clear ideological message, and he won four states on Super Tuesday. I'm a little depressed he lost Massachusetts, but I'd have to look closer at that.
Right.
So I think you're going to see that the center is really going to try and regroup. And I will guarantee you that if Hillary gets and Trump are the nominees, that a lot of the really big Republican corporate money will go to Hillary. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got no argument with her. She's a permanent war candidate. She's a corporate candidate. It'd be nice to have a woman in the White House, just like it was nice to have an African American with Obama. But politically, it's not going to mean much. So, but they were terrified of Bernie. They still are. He's done a great service. You know, he's aroused a generation of students and young people. He's been very clear in his message. He's been a great candidate, far superior to anything we could have imagined, really. And we owe him a great debt, I think. But there is no doubt. Well, let's put it this way. As Bernie points out, the economy is rigged, right? The election finance is rigged. Why wouldn't they take the tiny extra step to rig the voting machines?
Right.
I mean, these voting machines are completely vulnerable, and they can totally be hacked. We've had numerous public demonstrations of people hacking these voting machines. Somebody got on one of the voting machines and played Pac-Man, for God's sake. I mean, these things they're ridiculous. We need hand-counted, universal hand-counted paper ballots. But in this election, Don, we have a challenge. Bob Strakis and I are trying to set up a website. We want to get people to, in many states, they are required to post the results on a sheet of paper on the window of the precinct. Now, there's about 100,000. We estimate there's about 100,000 precincts in the country. And we would like to see how many people we can organize, certainly in the swing states, to get digital images of the vote count at the precinct. It's a little hard to manipulate at the precincts. I mean, it can be done. Obviously, it has been done. The real flipping is done on the statewide electronic vote counting. That's what they did in Ohio 2004. And they messed with it also in Florida 2000. So.
Yeah, they can scatter those across all of the precincts that way, and they're not so detectable.
Yes, it's a lot easier. So if we can get the Herculean task of getting digital images of all the postings at all the precincts, they're required to do it in Ohio, and we don't know what other states they're required, but if we can focus on the swing states, maybe we'll be able to have some kind of check. I mean, the reality, Don, is Germany, Japan, Ireland, Canada, and Romania all have universal hand-counted paper ballots. And in Germany in particular, the vote count, the actual vote count, correlates with the exit polls within a quarter of a percent. Now, here in the United States, what they do is when there's a big discrepancy between the electronic vote count and the exit polls, they adjust the exit polls. I mean, you know.
Yep. All right, on that note, we'll leave it there. Harvey, thank you very much. Harvey Wasserman, Solartopia.org. Always a pleasure.
Yes. And, Don, our new book coming out probably within the month.
Oh.
And we'll get you a copy. It's called The Strip to Flip Selection of 2016, Five Jim Crows and Electronic Election Theft. So we'll talk to you about that when it comes out.
Required reading for as early this year as people can get their hands on it. Some say that it almost doesn't matter who counts the vote or how it's counted, or even if it's correct at the end of the day. Those people say that the real show isn't the presidential election, but rather structural collapse of the entire system. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with Professor Anthony Montero from Philadelphia via telephone this past week.
One hesitates to always use the word crisis because we overuse it, but we're in something of a serious political crisis. You know, it's not just Trump, it's Bernie on the left side, and each of them, although Trump is closer to Wall Street and the ruling class than Bernie is, but each of them have followings that are set up with the old manner of doing things, but have not yet discovered what the new will look like. So I think we're probably at the end of a historic epoch of two parties, probably the post-World War II
epoch of politics in the United States is coming to an end at this time. So a 70-year cycle has ended.
Would it be unfair to talk about a crisis of legitimacy of both political parties and therefore of the duopoly system itself?
No question about it. You would have to call it a crisis of legitimacy. And it is one of those crises where the ruling elite cannot rule in the old way, the old duopoly, two-party system. And the people increasingly are not going to allow themselves to be ruled in the ways that they have been. So something new, perhaps, is about to be born.
The pressures on the Democratic side against the established duopoly seem to be coming from the young white side of the party.
Yeah, it is. At least that's who was out in front of this, kind of like with Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement is a next stage of the Occupy Wall Street movement. But I would not rule out the growing numbers of young black people who are attempting to find their way to the Bernie Sanders movement. I think that's very good stuff, and I think it bodes well for the future. Now, the obstacles in front of young black people are probably greater than for any other demographic in the political equation. But I think, in spite of the black Democratic Party politicians and the preachers and so on, that we're looking at young people who are going to find their way to Bernie Sanders or to this movement, which is bigger than Bernie Sanders and I think is going to last longer than Bernie Sanders.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Pro Libertad Freedom Campaign invites you to celebrate the 73rd birthday of Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera and to call for his immediate release. We're going to hear from Jesus Papalito Melendez, who is the poet laureate of Puerto Rico, Rafael Landrón, another stirring poet, Estela Vasquez, vice president of Local 1199, Service Employees International Union, former political prisoner Lynn Stewart, and former grand jury resister Bob Lederer. Let's listen.
73 years, Oscar Lopez Rivera. I can feel the vibes of what he meant. Just tell our listener, each one of you who have done your own time, what this man means to our freedom and self-determination. Lynn Stewart, then we're going to speak with Bob Lederer.
Okay, I just know that for me, Oscar always exemplifies two things. His brilliance, his political brilliance. He always is able to encapsulate an issue and speak about it. And here he is buried in the belly of the beast, and yet he sees it so clearly. Very much like Mumia, but in his own slant on it. And then the second thing is his endurance, that he has endured through all these years, all this solitary, everything, and he still is so bright, so energetic. He really is someone, live like him, live like Oscar Lopez.
And, you know, not everybody realizes that Bob Lederer, they don't realize that my brother Bob was a political prisoner. Maybe you just want to give one little sense of how you came to be inside and your thoughts on this 73rd birthday of what Oscar Lopez Rivera means to freedom-loving people.
Thanks, Mimi. Well, I was, and to this day remain, part of a movement against U.S. imperialism as a system and its policies at home and abroad in solidarity with people of color. And because of that involvement, I was called to a federal grand jury in 1985 that was trying to track down the people in that movement and basically asking us to become snitches. I was one of six people subpoenaed. All six of us took the long-time position that had been established by the Puerto Rican independence movement in 1936, which is non-collaboration. You do not cooperate with your enemy in destroying your movement, and was held in contempt and jailed for 3 months, in my case, in federal prison. What Oscar both represents and acts out in his life and has manifested in 34 years in federal prison is an uncompromising commitment to human freedom on every level. And of course, first and foremost, and the reason he was held, along with formerly up to 15 other people on charges of seditious conspiracy, is because he said that colonialism, as the United Nations has said, is absolutely wrong. It is a violation of international law, and people have a right to rise up and use any means necessary to fight against that. And that's why he's still doing the time. He rejected clemency by President Clinton in 1999 because it didn't cover some of his comrades who now have been released in the subsequent years. So he's, to me, an example of steadfastness and uncompromising commitment to freedom. And as I mentioned tonight, he has now unequivocally supported LGBT freedom, and that has inspired the leading LGBT rights organization in Puerto Rico to come out for his freedom as well, to link the issues, to connect the oppressions, and have mutual solidarity as we all fight for our freedom.
Bob Lederer, that was absolutely lyrical.
Solidarity comes in a lot of different forms, and the solidarity in the Puerto Rican community from our brothers and sisters in the Dominican community is centuries long. And I want to call up to the stage our Executive Vice President of 1199.
Gracias. And let me say that solidarity between our islands goes back a few hundred years. A Puerto Rican poet, Lola Rodriguez de Tio, said that Cuba and Puerto Rico were the two wings of a bird. And I say Dominican Republic and Haiti are the breast of that bird because we are right between the two islands. That solidarity goes back to Eugenio Maria de Hostos, who to this day still is buried in the Dominican Republic because he said he wanted to stay in the Dominican Republic until Puerto Rico became an independent country. And we are very proud to still have him in our island. I bring to you the solidarity also of 400,000 members of 1199 in Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and Florida. We want to join our voices to the demand, free Oscar Lopez Rivera now. All of you have followed you, the there is a group of white men in a state called Oregon with guns in their hand who have burned the land, and no one in this damn country is calling them terrorists. Those are the real terrorists in the United States.
Right.
Those
on.
Are the terrorists.
Right on.
Many of you, and I see Ralph and Lynn, some people of my generation, remember when our sisters and brothers of the American Indian Movement took over Wounded Knee, and you remember what happened in Wounded Knee. They sent the FBI to shoot the original inhabitants of this country. They were called terrorists, and yet these people are in Oregon with guns in their hands, and I don't hear anybody calling to send the FBI and take their guns away from them. But damn it, if it was anybody that looked like me, or like you, my brother, or had a Muslim last name, they would have sent tanks like they sent an army in occupation to Ferguson when people were protesting the assassination of an unarmed black youth. And we need to say this to our union members. We need to say that to our neighbors. We need to raise those voices in the churches. And today, we are here expressing our solidarity. And I would like to leave you with a slogan that I learned last year on May Day in Havana. And to say, along with Oscar López Rivera, y no nos da la gana de ser una colonia norteamericana. Y no nos da la gana de ser una colonia norteamericana. Feliz cumpleaños, compañero Oscar, y viva Puerto Rico libre.
So, brothers and sisters, I want you to think about working for social justice, freedom, working for the liberation of political prisoners, then becoming a political prisoner yourself, and then being out and continuing the work that you did that got you into jail, going back and doing that work. I want you to think about that cycle. That cycle is symbolic of the life of a people's lawyer named Lynn Stewart.
Just about 2 years ago, I came home and have confounded them and continued to put sticks in their eyes because they wanted me dead in 6 months. And here I am.
Yes, indeed.
But when I said I came home to my family, I don't only mean my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, my beloved Ralph. You are the family I have come home to, as is every political prisoner in those hell holes, in those death camps. And the more we hear and learn, the more we know how important our work is to spare no effort to bring them home soon. I was lucky enough this past fall to be out in Oakland and San Francisco and shared the stage with Oscar's brother. And Oscar's brother told us how when he was first placed in solitary, Oscar refused to have any visitors, refused to have any mail, refused to see anybody. And when they asked, why are you doing this to yourself? Why are you doing this to us? He said, because I can never show them that I have any weakness. I can never show them that they can win. And I think in this new year, perhaps we all ought to say that to ourselves. Take a page from Oscar's book and say, we cannot show weakness. We cannot give up this fight. We cannot say, well, I'll go to the rallies, or maybe I'll go picket in front of the jail. We have to dedicate ourselves to do everything possible to bring people home. Prison is like, it is sameness, deadening sameness, until someone lightens the load. So, folks, pick up your pen, pick up a postcard, pick up a beautiful card, pick up a calendar, pick up something and send it to one of the guys. They'll respond. Their letters are worth solid gold. The relationships you make with the political prisoners, they are our heroes. They are in jail for doing what we believed in doing, and we have to bring them home. So I say to you on this evening of Oscar's birthday, I hope he will be here to ride a camel next year in the Three Kings. I hope he'll be here even earlier to plan for Three Kings, because we know that Oscar is coming home.
Yes.
We will make it so. Thank you.
I need Las Amazonas de Oscar to come up to the stage. All of Oscar's Amazons that once a month come out, pick it, and call for Oscar's release. Our sister Marina Ortiz has a letter from Oscar. She wants to read a portion of it.
And so for his birthday, he got it so fast, and then he managed to write back to me.
Nice.
So I just wanted, it's a long letter. I just wanted to read a part of it. We have to be proud of being Puerto Ricans because our people have a heart full of compassion and of love for freedom and justice. It's that heart that will one day transform our homeland into the nation that it has the potential of being. A nation with a robust democratic system that will become an endemic garden for the enjoyment of our people and all of humanity. We can do it if we unite. We can do it because we have the most important resource. Puerto Ricans, y ustedes, with a solid formation, experience, and love for our national identity, culture, and for making this a better and more just world. Of course, we have to face many challenges, but we can do it. There's a lot more, and I'm going to post it on the 34 Mujeres Facebook page, but this is what we do, and every month we were in Times Square 3 months in a row, which was like amazing, but we're going to be again last Sunday of the month, as we have been for since March. We started in El Barrio, and we chant for 34 minutes now because it's 34 years, and it sort of sounds like...
Ahora es! Aquí están las mujeres luchando por Oscar! Ahora es! Aquí están!
You touched me. You yelled peace at your assassin and he killed you without mercy, proving the point of your slender fingers' accusation. Asesino! 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 Thus poets still sing your sad song of protest. Students with prudence embroiled in contemporary civil unrest manifest from generation to generation, their spirits not yet out of breath. But though they fight for life, they too, like you, fear not death. Antonia, you've touched us. Your 21 years just starting life, felled without defense. A tiny bullet that made you fall. Your blood still stains upon our wall. Metallic, sweet, and warm, that I am brought to mourn when I think maybe we could have sat together as friends, talking like people, sharing laughter, and planning perhaps the liberation of Puerto Rico. Let me say then to the blowing winds, to the whims of minds that may carry my voice through the diaspora of you, you are the innocence that tries to make common sense out of Puerto Ricans pitted against Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico, throwing rocks and bottles,
rubber bullets and tear gas, putting into practice blatant torture tactics as the hypocrisy of democracy tolerates in this world. Nevertheless, the youth goes marching with your acumen for the human right to transform intelligence into utter human excellence. So let it not take another death to avenge for us to realize once again the bloody cost that it costs to educate a life. Lest we forget, this is revolutionary, and there are no innocent people, Antonia. Oh, there are just no innocent
people. So I am very privileged to be with outstanding activists, poets, freedom fighters, in their own rights, and we are here on the 73rd birthday of Oscar Lopez Rivera. And the question really is what Oscar means and his sacrifices to people who are freedom-loving. Why don't we start with our poet laureate?
Okay, Jesus Papoleto Melendez here. In the final analysis, what Oscar represents in his imprisonment is the hypocrisy of the U.S. justice system in relation to its colonization of Puerto Rico and its disregard for the U.N. Charter and all those other things. He's our lone prisoner now who personifies that because he's still there. And the crisis in Puerto Rico, the financial crisis, where it seems like being guilty for negligent parents giving their three-year-old a credit card, then they get mad when he goes berserk, of course. But that's not the analysis. The analysis is a disregard for Puerto Rican people and disregard for the nation and its sovereignty. So now we're in debt to American...
Are you suggesting that the colonial status of Puerto Rico is the roots of the current economic...
Because, you know, it's an economic slavery, you know. I think after the Civil War, the United States decided to make everybody a slave. So they started with their own people, and they call it jobs now. Everybody's a slave to their job.
Spoken,
you know,
like a poet.
But then, you know, also they went around and enslaved everybody. The job of the President of the United States is to create new markets for U.S. products. So that's what that's about, you know.
And you, my brother?
This is Rafael Landron. I guess to me, Oscar represents the strength and fortitude of someone who's really his convictions against someone who could stand up and chose to end colonialism. You know, that's what he represents, a real hero, someone who is strong, who has love and compassion. You know, I'm just very inspired by his life.
Thank you all, and we will make it so. We will bring Oscar Lopez Rivera home, along with all our political prisoners.
I'm going to call up to a stage a writer, a poet, and an activist, Rafael Landron, who weaves these extraordinary pieces of freedom, these quilts that we just wrap ourselves up in and love it. So, compañero, ven, Rafael Landron.
My hands hold tightly onto iron cages. You see, I've chosen to end colonialism. And so it is, through all types of revisions, conclusions, and judgments, I chose, and no one can take that away. What a life I've led, love through plexiglass, wire handles, learned to appreciate family visitation, love chats, learned to love intensely through lights out and drop-ins, but do not pity me because I chose, and no one can take that away. Through bow, I need your pity, I need you to live greatly. Stand, my friends, we can change the world. Our lives do make differences, our choices do create realities. Stand and choose bravely. Take on the biggest challenges, the ones you feel in the darkest hours, those quiet moments of reflection where we can sense our power. Create a better place to live. On dreams of Yunque waterfalls, I pledge myself to the earth. I commit myself to the Yautía and the Yuca. Only they know the truth. Why stand by and see them dug up by greedy machines stored up in corporate boardrooms where profits rule? I stand for the Malanga and for the Flamboyant. I stand for the Morir Vivir plant that closes at the touch. And you may judge me, but I won when I chose. And when it comes down to it, I love you too, When I go, you can wrap me in palm leaves and put me where I come from, because I'm coming back as a plantain who will be picked by my children's children, who will tell stories of ancestors long gone who chose freedom.
Okay, we'll ask her. Le-lo-la, 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 le-lo-la. I am that beautiful Boricua growing like a flamboyant through concrete, breaking through with my gnarly roots showing, exposed to the terrifying and beautiful world in which it came. Boricua breaking ground, flowering in all my amapola glory, scared and invincible simultaneously. I am love like rain falling over en el yunque. I am the tree that won't stop growing until it reaches the sunlight beyond the darkness of the rainforest. I am the concrete rupturing madness of love. I remember. They came for me in 1492. I was deep within El Yunque, covered in the shade. I heard the cannon and the splash of the anchor when it hit the sea. I looked at him from a distance, and we saw each other. Looking back, I saw myself transplanted amongst time and space. I flashed back. They brought them from the east, the darker ones who had come before, the white man trading with us from the beginning. I am he and he me, hand in hand. We showed each other. I showed him the beauty of El Yunque. We sat and began to build, tired of the ones who made us search for gold like a sickness. They were sick with greed for the shiny stones. They cut off our hands if we did not find what they wanted. It was then when the war started, and we fled to our sacred mother in El Yunque to plan our revolt. They continued to bring our African brothers to do the work that we refused, and that's when we would come down from the mountains and free them. They came to live with us and learn our ways, and we would fight arm in arm against the greedy ones who tried to convert us to their crosses while they beat us, our children. They came at us with Bible and bombs, and we fought back with everything we've had. Some of our mothers chose to drown our own children rather than subject them to the cruelty of these greedy ones. And so it was as time passed, and the Spanish blood mixed with us as well as the African. The conqueror's blood is now a part of mine, and I have to live with myself knowing what was done. Now Spanish is the language that I speak. We took the God as our own, but we changed it and have mixed in what we have learned from the Africans. And we pray now to a man on the cross, but also give offerings to our antepasados, to the Creator, to the great gods of Xangó, Abatalá, Ogun. They have survived the conquest, and so did some of our Taino ways. We hid it in their Bibles, but we still exist. It is now 1898, and the greedy sickness has passed on to another. We finally kicked out the Spanish, but a new greedy ones have arrived from the north who wants our land for sugarcane and our oceans for military means. They call themselves the United States, here to liberate ourselves from the evils of the Spanish crown. They want us to learn English now. They worship the paper that is green. We are still cutting cane, more of the same. But we learned from our brethren in Haiti, who threw off the greedy ones in 1804. Alas, it's 2016. In my blood runs the blood of the oppressor and oppressed, the conqueror and slave, the indio and claro, lobo y negro. Which side of me will I choose? Who will I honor? What is my root? Will I worship the gold and green paper? Will I be corrupted by the sickness of greed? Or will I rise like a true Taino African Spanish warrior that I am and choose to be kind, choose to love over hate? I choose my antepasados, all of them, with their mistakes and fury, to mark my life and not make the same mistakes. I know in the past lies the answer to my present. I want to love and be open. I conjure up the power of El Yunque to help me liberate myself from my own demons of greed, hate, and insecurity. I know I can trust my root. My antepasados will save me from myself and bless me. In my blood runs the rain of El Yunque, the moon's strong ocean tides. I am that beautiful Boricua, invincible and strong. I honor who it is that I am, and I love every inch.
Happy birthday, Oscar Lopez Rivera. Come home soon, and we must make that so.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
This song goes out to the new slaves, the new blacks, new Jews, the new minorities for whom we need a civil rights movement.
Going uptown to Harlem, gonna let my hair down in Harlem.
On the side of my head, gonna go up to Harlem
and have a good time.
I got too many clothes to find a place in the closet, hands out in the light. I am exemplary.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Indonesia's anti-queer crackdown worsens. LGBT youth activists close in on Harlem homophobe, and Kenyan rappers face showdown over equal love videos. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 27th, 2016. LGBT lives are quite literally being threatened now in the world's fourth most populous nation, Indonesia. We updated you last week about the bans on pro-LGBT content on TV and social media, and about the country's leading Muslim clerics calling for same-gender lovemaking to be outlawed. More followers of Mohammed live in Indonesia than anywhere else on the planet. The country's former Information and Communications Minister and current MP, Tifatul Sembering, said in a tweet on February 26 that Islam calls for the execution of gay people. A saying of the Prophet, he wrote, referencing Sodom and Gomorrah, Whomever you find committing the acts of the community of Lot should be put to death. He soon deleted the tweet after a hail of criticism. One religious scholar suggested that Sembring was importing the rhetoric of the Islamic State, which brags about killing gay men.
The Indonesian Psychiatrists Association jumped in with a declaration of its own this week that homosexuality and gender dysphoria are mental disorders that can be cured with proper treatment. In the city of Yogyakarta, Indonesia's only Islamic school for transgender women was shut down on February 25th. Police officials had banned a rally at the Yogyakarta Monument planned by Democracy Struggle Solidarity, an LGBT support group, 2 days earlier.
Earlier in the week, Defense Minister Riyamizat Ryakudu called LGBT people more dangerous than nuclear war because, he told the Tempo News website, "We can't see who our foes are, but out of the blue, everyone is brainwashed." The assault on LGBT people began in January, with Higher Education Minister Muhammad Nasir reacting to the formation of an unauthorized support group for sexual minorities at the University of Indonesia. He called for a ban on all out LGBT students because their existence violates the nation's standards and morals.
Analysts can't explain the rapid upsurge in anti-LGBT abuse, but Agence France-Presse reported that it follows a push by religious leaders and conservative politicians to bolster public morality in Indonesia, with crackdowns on prostitution and the availability of drugs and alcohol. LGBT activists also say that the advent of marriage equality in the United States last June has heightened fears by some government officials that similar efforts will be launched in Indonesia, even though LGBT people have no rights at all in the country. Some equality activists are pinning their hopes on President Joko Widodo, who earned the backing of most LGBT people after promising to address human rights abuses and champion minority groups. But he's been silent so far.
Sexual minorities continue to be robbed of their dignity in Russia. Any public expression of support for LGBT rights is already criminalized in the country, with the blessing of President Vladimir Putin. The Ministry of Health this week proposed the creation of clinics throughout the country to treat LGBT people. Sexology exam rooms would address disorders of sexual preference and gender identity disorders as mental and behavioral disorders that are lumped in with pedophilia. The rooms would be located inside primary care clinics and psychiatric hospitals, and according to a government website, would be required to stock at least one dildo, although it wasn't exactly clear why.
The clinics would provide court-ordered forced treatment when necessary. They would also diagnose and treat sexual deviations among children and youth and consult youth about their sexual education and knowledge of gender. Russian Health Ministry official Georgi Gubinov, who is reportedly behind the proposal, said his agency would be taking feedback from the public before going forward. He is the same man who proposed rules last year to prevent transgender people from getting driver's licenses. While restrictions were enacted in January 2015, their practical effect has apparently been negligible. The clinic's proposal was published on February 19th, the same day that Russia lawmakers offered a brief respite from attacks on sexual minorities by rejecting a bill that would have made coming out a crime. Conversion or reparative therapy has been soundly debunked by every reputable mental health organization in the U.S. and most of the Western world.
A coalition of U.S. LGBT advocacy groups filed a landmark consumer fraud complaint this week with the Federal Trade Commission against the Virginia-based People Can Change and all practitioners of so-called ex-gay therapy. The Human Rights Campaign, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the Southern Poverty Law Center charge that the group preys on vulnerable LGBT people and families by using damaging and discredited claims that it can change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. The complaint alleges that People Can Change violates Federal Trade Commission guidelines by claiming that homosexuality is a mental illness and that its services have a basis in science. It's also charged with using unsubstantiated testimonials to defraud consumers. The complaint builds on arguments used in a successful lawsuit against a New Jersey group last year for making the same claims. A jury ordered that group to pay thousands of dollars in damages to former patients.
Samantha Ames is one of the attorneys with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. This historic complaint is not only the first clear opportunity the Obama administration has had to end these deadly practices for good, she said, but if investigated fully, it could very well be the final nail in the coffin of the entire conversion therapy industry.
Lawmakers in the Italian Senate dumped an adoptions provision from a civil union's proposal this week in order to get the basic partnership bill approved. The abandoned provision would simply have allowed couples in civil unions to adopt their partners' biological children. But Roman Catholic Church officials, opposed to civil unions, protested most loudly that the adoptions provision would open the door to surrogacy, which is outlawed in the country. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has repeatedly promised to enact a civil unions bill. In a high-stakes gamble, he called a confidence vote on his leadership and legislative agenda on February 25th. If he'd lost that vote, he would have been forced to resign. The measure without the adoptions provision then passed in the Senate by a lopsided vote of 173-71 and was hailed by Renzi as historic. Some equality advocates, however, condemned it as a betrayal. Flavio Romani, president of the LGBT rights group Archigay, told Reuters that the law that has come out of all this is lacking its heart. The bill now goes to Parliament's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, where its passage is widely expected to be easy. Italy is currently the only major country in Europe without some form of legal recognition for lesbian and gay couples.
Lawmakers in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, proved this week that words can indeed be empty. They voted down several pro-LGBT bills just a day after declaring a first-ever LGBT Rights Day on February 23rd. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling coalition rejected six bills proposed by the opposition that would have, among other actions, banned so-called conversion therapy for minors, created civil unions for same-gender couples, recognized a slain soldier's same-gender partner or the same-gender parents of a slain soldier, and required health professionals to learn about LGBT issues. During the debate on the bills, Health Minister Yaakov Litzman of the far-right United Torah Judaism Party said private consensual adult same-gender lovemaking was the same kind of sin as worshiping the golden calf. The Meretz party's Michael Rosen, who sponsored the bill to train health professionals to deal with LGBT issues, said Litzman was betraying his responsibility as health minister. "I didn't ask you to be minister for gays and lesbians," he said. "What you did here was neither Jewish nor humane." M.K. Zippy Livni of the Zionist Union Party told reporters that, "We will keep fighting until this government stands behind its words."
In other news, an LGBT rights group is working with Berlin's city council to open a shelter for queer Syrian refugees. Organizers say it will house at least 120 people. Stefan Jockel of the Berlin Homosexual Council told reporters that LGBT refugees need special attention because of the often violent abuse they suffer from their peers, made even worse by anti-queer authorities in migrant camps in other countries. Another organizer, Marcel de Groot, cited stories of anti-LGBT violence in Berlin shelters. "People must be able to live without fear of violence or discrimination," he said. According to Agence France-Presse, a smaller shelter, with space for 8 LGBT refugees, opened on February 1st in the southern city of Nuremberg, the first of its kind in Germany.
And finally, returning to Indonesia, Tangerang Mayor Arief Wismansyah wins the prize for the most outrageous claims coming out of the escalating condemnation of LGBT people in the Muslim-majority Southeast Asian nation. He told a city-run pregnancy seminar this week that baby formula and instant noodles could make infants gay. "Parents are often so busy that they only feed their children formula and instant foods," he said. "So it's no wonder that recently there are more LGBT." Well, that explains it.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 27th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
On the menu this week, it's a Take That Bigot burger on a liberating Kenyan rap roll, starting with a new remix of Macklemore and Ryan Lewis's 2014 Grammy Best Song nominee, Same Love. Members of the musical group Art Attack could be arrested at any time, and an actor from their YouTube video has fled the country after the remix was banned by the Kenya Film Classification Board. Still, Art Attack stands by their work. As feature rapper Noti Flo said in a Facebook post, "Arrest us if you wish. We are unbowed."
This song goes out to the new slaves, the new blacks, new Jews, the new minorities for whom we need a civil rights movement. Maybe a sex rights movement, especially in Africa, everywhere. This goes out to you. I feel you. This is my story, y'all. My sorry story, y'all. This is me, this is you, this is us, this is the world. Wild war, cold war, love war. He is back and fell in love with the American in school. He was cool, he was funny, always true, always shiny. My heart told me I was right. I could go ahead and love him, I could go ahead and hug him, I could go ahead and hug him. He was never judgmental, always stood by my side. Always there when I called him, show support when I'm falling. We spent all the days together, every weekend sharing stories. Summer, winter, every weather, life was full of all glories in his eyes. I was a sparkle and my heart was spinning circle. And one day I went and told him that I thought I was a psycho, cause I was in love with a boy like me. But he told me no one ever gave him joy like me. So he came close, switched arms and hugged me tight. And he told me never leave me, please love me right. It was strange cause I was a man just like him. I really couldn't explain it, but I just liked him. I did.
And I can't change, even if I wanted to.
Going through, I told her I love the boy and they love me too. Mommy flipped and started cussing me, running to daddy, and told daddy our son's going crazy already. Our decision was a wrap too, you know what I was saying. Fuck your back, shameless, hating and follow the sin. I sang down to my knees, trying to call her to mama. Mama said, I ain't your mommy, you're the son of the devil. And daddy said, go through, for a strong on your devil. And for the last 6 years, my parents have never seen me. Every day I bleed tears, hoping that they wish to see me and die. I'm for the public cause I'm scared of the jail. Cause if they ever caught me, they would throw me in jail. You're a criminal, how dare you, falling in love. It's a crime to follow your heart and follow your love. I'm breaking the constitution, going through a separation. Freakanization power to the black nation. Church rules, street rules, court rules, school rules, hate. It's the new love, kill me, talk tough. Homophobia, it's the new African culture. Everyone's the police, everyone's a cop judge. More blood, street justice. Kill them when you see them. Blame it on the West, never blame it on love. It's an Africa to try and show a brother some love.
I can't change, even if I try, even if I wanted to. My love, my love, my love, she keeps me warm. She keeps me warm. She keeps me warm. She keeps me warm.
She keeps me warm. Yeah, shout out to my brothers, Vinya Vanga, Georgie Barrow, and my lay sisters everywhere in the struggle. Always love from your heart, never love from society. The hate is too much, all in the name of piety. Again, it's staying strong, Nigeria, Africa. It's time for new laws, no time for new wars. We come from the same God, cut from the same cord. Share the same pain and share the same skin. The march is still on, Luther's spirit lives on. It's a bedroom struggle and also a street struggle. Judge less and love more, stand up and stand tall. Talk tough for talk not, we gon' love and love more, y'all.
Change.
Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is selfless. Love is faithful. Love is full of hope. Love is full of trust. Love is not proud. Love is God and God is love. According to the words of Loretta Young, love is not something you find. Love is something that finds you.
You can further annoy the Kenyan government by sharing Art Attack's Same Love Remix YouTube video. More queer Kenyan rap later in the program.
From Comedy Central's World News Headquarters in New York, this is The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
Pastor James Manning has been a Comedy Central favorite, but someone else may get the last laugh at his Otla World Missionary Church. Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams was surprised to get some seriously good news when she recently revisited Harlem's Herald of Homophobic Hate.
We'd met with the Reverend once in 2009.
Obama is indeed the next Hitler.
And again in 2015.
I think that Starbucks has recognized that the flavor of their lattes, that they are using semen to make that latte even more flavorful.
I sat down with Dr. Manning to find out what in the hell was going on this time.
The city of New York, the Blasio administration in particular, is trying to foreclose on our property over a damn water bill.
Have you been paying your water bill?
We're tax exempt. We're a church. Churches do not pay water bills or any other kind of tax for that matter.
Actually, that's bull. After a long legal battle, a 2007 Court of Appeals ruled that the church was ineligible for the water exemption. So that little thing, as well as over $1 million in separate claims against the church, prompted the foreclosure.
The Sodomites have launched a campaign over the last 2.5 years to try to silence my very vocal and truthful and commanding voice in this community. Many of them have moved up here to this particular community. Going uptown to Harlem, gonna let my hair down in Harlem.
I'm a sodomite, gonna go up to Harlem.
And have a good time.
And have a good old time.
And I have to say this as well. A lot of them came up here looking for black meat.
For what?
Black meat.
What is black meat?
Sex with black men.
Oh my God. Why do you say stuff like this?
I think jungle fever could be one of the terms.
I met with the man who wants to buy the property, Carl Siciliano. But it turns out he's not exactly planning to put up high-rise condos.
I run a program for homeless LGBT youth, kids that have been thrown out of their home. What I'd like to do is fill the building with young people who are currently sleeping in the streets.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Let me just wrap my head around this right now. You want to kick out a church that is very homophobic and put in young LGBT youth?
It's 3 blocks away from our drop-in center. It would be a perfect place for our young people to live.
What? That's amazing. That is great.
But the Reverend isn't concerned that the largest LGBT youth center in the country wants to move in, because he's carefully analyzed the legal proceedings and he's come to this logical conclusion.
Before this church is foreclosed on, sodomites will carry babies in their testicles for 9 months and then gestate them out of their asses before this church is closed.
You're saying people are going to start having butt babies before this church is foreclosed then?
People are never going to have butt babies. So it's never going to happen.
So you're going to fight this thing?
Oh, absolutely.
But Dr. Manning, they're saying that you owe over $1 million. That is a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
You don't have the money, do you?
Aw, that's a shame. Well, when the auction comes, the forecast is for butt babies. And won't that be the ultimate twist?
You're having my baby. Oh, what a lovely way of saying how much you love me.
While The Daily Show's Jessica Williams awaits the arrival of Pastor James David Manning's butt babies, a lot more people have been showing how much they love queer youth by donating over $300,000 to the hashtag Harlem No Hate campaign for the purchase of Otla's church building. A restraining order has stayed the auction until late April, giving Carl Siciliano and his LGBT youth Ali Forney Center more time to arrange a deal. Stay tuned.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill,
reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
We close our Kenyan rap package this week with a new single by lesbian artist Gramo Suspect called Our Love Is Valid. Like Art Attack, she's putting her career and maybe her life on the line to talk about the African continent's real LGBT history.
If I say that all my dreams are valid, I bet most of you will agree. But if I tell the details of the same dreams, funny most would disagree. We all got dreams under different grounds for me. Some about being a honoree and some erotic and exotic action to a very high degree. Through the hallway to the room that I lay, my partner makes a graceful entry. Foxy walk and sexy smile, fine body, enticing booty covered by an elegant lingerie. I know most of you expected another dress code, like a suit, maybe a tuxedo, and you'd rather a dungaree. So you shout nightmare, but in my dream you can't be a referee. But your noise don't stop my dream. I'm deaf, but not dumb, so I tell of this brie. Around her neck, wrist and waist, she wore appealing ornaments with filigree. Soothing, captivating smell is what hits me when she attacks and does things I could never dream. In no time I'm nude, not even with my spiritual pagari. Intimate journey of mutual consent in both parties are lead to a jamboree. Where different kind of music features starring the chivalry. A major event with variety of food, mukimo, mbucha, biryani, even puri. We live happily ever after the executive ceremony that we kill with a French dance called Bori. I open my eyes with gladness, but it's cut short by the news of this decree. Some head of state signed the bill using false concept as a pedigree. Has he forgotten the history of the court of Kabaka, King Mwanga? Ignorance earns no one a degree. Or maybe he don't know the concept among Nilotical Lango called Mukodo Dako. By now, he should be a retiree. Just like the stars, we shine and way too many to count 1, 2, 3. Some of us live frugally and hoard what you have, and others dissipated in a wild spree. Do you remember Akhenaten, the Egyptian pharaoh and Smenkari? Wow, that couple was over free. Astrologers, tradition healers were the terms in pre-colonial Burkina Faso. I'm not a chicory. Bian Nkuma, a transmitted medicine for wealth that was considered germ-free. All over Central Africa among Azande warriors, I'm not a filler tree. Check out ancient paintings of Bushmen. Don't they depict intimate activity? South African Chibari, Bahimas of Uganda, Oneki of Kikuyu, this is an African tree. Nzinga, a warrior woman in the Ndongo kingdom of the Bundu, ruled as a king, carefree. The people of Buganda and Africa in general need to be set free. Free to dream, free to live the dream. We human, we can't live in a ree. Free will to live with whoever we dream of. We can't be tied to an axle tree. There are way too many gods. Hard to choose the real from the illusionary. Which one do I serve? Allah, Guy, the god of Akikuyu, Nyasai of the Luo, or the one of the Calvary? Different scriptures, even the Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda, claim to be following the word when sending people to the mortuary. A variety of cultures, some great, others pathetic. Female genital mutilation is slavery. A religious leadership role called Mugabe among Meru of Kenya existed way before missionary. Ganga ya Tibanta, a priest of gigs in the Congo, was contemporary. But all these gods, scriptures and cultures, shares love that is mandatory. Rainbow Way is all about love, free will in both parties, so don't compare it with burglary.
And most of you do relate, so don't you act like the term homosexual is a vocabulary. If you're living in the closet or doing it behind your wife's back, your sons and daughters will have me to thank for bravery. I am biologically programmed within, beyond no choice, hence this is not temporary. And I'm not any less for a person in God's eyes. Pertaining his love and kingdom, I am a beneficiary. It's not a lifestyle. One has no choice. Not a fantasy, but an identity. Happens naturally, no forgery. Embracing the orientation is the only realistic route to mental health and happy living, shows discovery. Praises be to my maker, for I'm wonderfully and beautifully made. Quite the opposite of a mockery. Grimy suspect, I got too many clothes to find a place in the closet, hands out in the light. I am exemplary.
Grimy suspect's Our Love is Valid single and video are available online. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones and Michael LeBeau contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. We featured Kenya's Art Attack and Grimy Suspect, and some of the other music you heard was by Corey Monteith. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KZSC Santa Cruz, California, WHRW Binghamton, New York, KPOV Bend, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, this week's show is about abortion. That's right, we're visiting abortion again. The right to abortion is a basic human right. That's it. That's said, that's done. It's the right of a woman to control her own body. Think about it. If a woman can't make basic decisions about her own body, including the very important decision of whether to have a baby, then she is a slave. Now, we're going to hear two interviews today. At the back end of the show, we'll hear part of an interview I did earlier this year with Sansara Taylor. This was right before the January 22nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the court decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. We talk about why there's an abortion rights emergency, why we need an actual revolution to emancipate women, and why people need to act now for abortion rights. Sansara Taylor is an ardent follower of Bob Avakian, a fighter for his leadership in the new synthesis of communism that he's developed and brought forward, and a revolutionary communist herself. She writes for Revolution Newspaper, www.revcom.us, and she is the key initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. As I said, this is just part of the interview. The full interview is available at themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, themichaelslateshow.com. And right now we're going to hear an interview I did with Dawn Porter, the director of the film Trapped, a film that's being released right now, has been showing on HBO, and which tells the story of clinic workers and others who are fighting to keep clinics open. Trapped is the new film by Dawn Porter, and it follows the struggles of clinic workers and lawyers who are on the front lines of a battle to keep abortion safe and legal for millions of women in this country. The film was awarded the U.S. Documentary Special Jury Award for Social Impact Filmmaking at Sundance this year. And let me tell you, folks, it is a film that really will knock you back in your seats. It's just a very powerful film. It really, really brings out not only the need for people to step up and fight to preserve the right to an abortion, but also what it has to do with recognizing and upholding the humanity of women as, you know, a whole big part of the human race. I can't do any of this. And joining us to talk about all this now is Dawn Porter. Dawn is the filmmaker of Trapped, and she's also the filmmaker of an earlier film that was similar in content, which was called Gideon's Army, and that was about the struggles of public defenders to fight for justice for people that never get it in this society, all right? And in a similar vein, this is what Trapped is all about, demanding that the rights of women to humanity and to an abortion, in which all this is concentrated up, are protected, defended, and extended, all right, all over the country. So, Dawn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I saw your film when it premiered at Sundance, and it was such a, you know, moving piece. I mean, it was one of those things where you're just nailed to your seat and your eyes are nailed to the screen and you're following this through. And the whole thing that got concentrated in there really brought out a lot to me in terms of the kind of situation that one, that women are facing today, and that generally people everywhere have to stand up to, the question of whether or not certain sections of people are going to be robbed of their humanity by the functioning of the system or not. And what are we going to do about it in the face of that? And I thought this film was a great contribution to saying we can't step back and just sit down and go to sleep when all this is happening. So I wanted to ask you the compulsion you faced to make this film. What made you make this film?
You know, I had spent a lot of time in the South when I was making my first film, Gideon's Army, about public defenders. And I was making a film called Spies of Mississippi that was on PBS. And that film was about how the Mississippi state government infiltrated the NAACP. And, you know, people understand how the federal government did that in the South during the civil rights era. But the story of how the state government targeted civil rights workers and leaders was less well known. So I was kind of in that mindset of thinking about how government can, you know, is not always as equal and is not always the benevolent help that we expect. And so I read in the newspaper I was in Jackson, Mississippi, and I read in the newspaper that there was one abortion clinic left. And I just couldn't believe it. And it was kind of what you're speaking to about my own feeling of I had been complacent. I'm a pro-choice person. I'm a person who's politically aware. How could I not see this happening? And then I started really thinking about this is not just the South. This is a systemic issue. So I really wanted to try and show how it could possibly be the case that a federally protected constitutional right, which is the right to bodily integrity and 14th Amendment protections, how could legislators at the state level be enacting legislation that directly influenced and could take that away? So that's kind of the approach I had to the film. So it's very much, for me, a question of what is the proper functioning of any governmental system.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you did, and this is extremely important for people who are going to see the film or who are debating whether they should see the film, the point that you did that really struck me very heavily was you laid out from the very beginning what the situation is today, both what are the clinics facing and what are the stakes involved?
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. I mean, in a horrifying way, if you believe in access, in abortion access. But since 2010, so for the last 5, now going on 5.5 years, state legislatures across America have passed what are known as TRAP laws. So that's targeted regulation of abortion providers. So they're laws that regulate the width of a hallway or how many parking spaces you can have. Or some of the most effective laws are that a doctor who provides abortion has to have admitting privileges to a local hospital. That sounds like it's good for health and safety, but what happens is the local hospitals will not grant those privileges. So you get into this Kafkaesque catch-22 where the state requires you to have something that's impossible to get. And as a result, clinics have started to close. So we have, I believe it's five states in America right now where there's only one abortion clinic in the entire state. Mm. We have in Texas where more than half of the clinics have closed. And that's even though parts of the Texas TRAP laws have been stayed pending a Supreme Court decision in a case that's going to be argued in March and decided in June. So you have had this radical and extreme closing of abortion clinics because of these types of laws. They've been remarkably effective. I think most people understand the dangers that abortion providers face, the physical dangers from people who would kill them. But the most effective strategy for closing clinics has not really been the extremists, it has been these legislators. And so that's what the movie follows clinic owners who are trying to comply with the laws with varying degrees of success.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that brings that too, and this, these laws were actually specifically written to, it seemed to me, they were specifically written to, in fact, ensure that the clinics would not be able to function. I mean, even there's some scenes in the film where things are mandated that can't possibly be done, or it says see this section here and you go there and there's no section there explaining
the
what
section,
you, yeah, or the thing about the doctors and what, you know, there's a whole thing. It's just, it was a very moving moment where there was a young woman who had been, I think she was gang raped, and she was she was just a kid, and she
13.
And because of these trapped laws, these trap laws that she was not able to actually, you know, what it required would mean that she would not really be able to get the abortion that she really needed, you know,
that's right,
at that moment.
Well, I think, you know, and it's really important to think about how the laws have progressed over time and also to think about who's behind the laws. So there's a group, Americans United for Life, and they have been dedicated to overturning Roe v. Wade since Roe v. Wade. So they, for example, paid for the lawyers that argued the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision in 1993. When Roe v. Wade was decided, the Supreme Court struck a bright line test. It said you cannot regulate abortion at the state level in the first trimester. What 20 years later in the Casey decision, the Supreme Court, with these argues paid, lawyers paid for by Americans United for Life, were successful in securing the ability of states to regulate abortion clinics for quote-unquote health and safety. Well, if you don't define what health and safety means, and health and safety is traditionally something that's governed by state governments, it's caused a lot of chaos. And that's, you're seeing the effect of that decision combined with, in 2008, state governments being overtaken by very conservative Tea Party and very conservative activists. So that 1-2 combination has led to passing all of these laws that have been, you know, the Americans United for Life drafts modeled legislation. They try it out in one state. If it works there, that state will pass it on to another state. And so you see this slow erosion of the protections and access to abortion services. So I feel like it's definitely a film about abortion access, but it's also a film about what happens when you have a group like this targeted at a social issue, and how can they effectively use the government process to achieve their ends? So one of the things I was trying to do is say, this sounds like it's complicated and it's hard to follow. What the results are not that hard to follow. You have situations where thousands, tens of thousands of women are not receiving an abortion that they would otherwise elect, and often with pretty, you know, heartbreaking results. And that's happening in far too many places.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to add on to that, the one scene, I can't remember the man's name, but he was the chief justice of the, was it in Alabama?
His name is Roy Moore, Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court.
Yeah, and he also happens to be the biggest anti-abortion guy in the world, apparently. And
he is. Yeah.
Go ahead.
He has a foundation that was dedicated to writing anti-abortion legislation, to writing anti-gay legislation. He's one of the holdouts who's still refusing to sanction gay marriage, even in the face of a Supreme Court decision. And so you have a situation where the elected Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, the person who is charged with enforcing the laws of the land, is avowedly anti-choice and has a foundation that is dedicated to overturning the laws that he's supposed to enforce. So it's just a very bizarre situation. And if people are not, you know, I always say I kind of aim this movie, and Vivian's Army as well, at people like me. You know, it's not that we don't care about these issues, but we think that they're taken care of, and they're really not. And it's really up to people who, you know, have beliefs that are not in keeping with a very conservative right-wing agenda. It's up to all of us to make sure we understand what's happening in our states, particularly at a state and local level. This is not a Southern issue or Southern problem. It is a nationwide problem.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, too, is, you know, people – we've talked a little bit about this, the sort of the mechanical things going on and the requirements they set out to, for an abortion clinic to have, whether it's the nurse anesthetist or whether it's, you know, certain amount of drugs on hand that are never going to be used because there's never that kind of, there's never a call for them. But it's wearing the clinics down. It's you know, taking their money. It's trying to drive them into bankruptcy or just not being able to function.
Yeah.
But there's also the question of the doctors, which I found extremely powerful in your film, because you have these doctors that you present as, you know, who are doing this because they really, really believe in it. And yet this whole thing that's going after them in terms of needing admitting privileges in a hospital before they can be allowed to perform an abortion in a clinic, this is very heavy stuff, because it's not like these people are incompetent doctors. It's not like they're, you know, or even that, you know, they're in a situation apparently where the need to get anybody admitted is very, very slight, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's really, once you start to understand the mechanics of how this works, it's really pretty, it's kind of horrifying. So, you know, first you had a situation where doctors were being killed, you know, clinics were bombed. So you have a number of doctors who are saying, quite legitimately, I'm not willing to take that risk to practice my profession. So they stopped providing abortion services. Then you have a lot of pressure and harassment from states that are hostile to abortion. So you have a situation where doctors in local communities that are anti-choice stop providing services. So the only way in the last 5 years in particular that abortion clinics, particularly in southern states or states like South Dakota, out kind of in the heartland, some heartland states, the only way that you have doctors who can provide abortions is if people are flying in. So you have a situation where, like in Alabama, there are 5 doctors who will provide abortions in the whole state. None of them live full-time in the state. But because of that, you have the situation where to schedule a doctor at a clinic is very, very challenging. So you have people flying all over to provide services. So Dr. Parker, who's followed in my film, flies to 3 different clinics in Alabama. Then he goes to Mississippi. He goes to Georgia. And so he's in this constant loop of providing where there's no local folks. And then on top of that, you have a situation. So while we were at Sundance, while on the day after the film premiered, the clinic in Tuscaloosa, which is one of the clinics that Dr. Parker works at and is one of the clinics we featured in the film, the health department came in for a quote-unquote surprise inspection. And so while the clinic owner was out of town and Dr. Parker was out of town, the staff is there in the clinic. The health department says, we want to see all of your records. We want to see all of your admissions. The clinic's only been open for 4 months. So clinics are used to, everybody is open to health and safety, making sure everything's up to par. But what they usually do is this leads to a situation where they find a quote-unquote deficiency. So, for example, during this surprise inspection, they said there was not a cap on a bottle of medicine. So it's those kinds of things. And it's this kind of like constant, imagine running your business with somebody dropping in for surprise inspections and kind of picking away at every procedure. So you have to have a physician and a clinic owner that's not only willing to work in a hospital environment, but is also really overregulated. And I would love for people to think about, we have a healthcare crisis in this country. We don't have enough physicians supplying services, particularly to poor people. And a lot of these public clinics are frequented by poor people. If you have insurance, you can go to your own doctor and have an abortion, or you can leave the state and go someplace where it's not quite so controversial. If you don't have the means to leave your state or your local place, you go to one of these public clinics. And these are the people that are being the most heavily hit by this over-regulation. So, you know, it really makes you think about who is bearing the brunt of these regulations. Who are those people?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dawn Porter. Dawn is the director of a fantastic new film that I saw at Sundance recently, and the film is called Trapped, and it's about the trap laws that are aimed at shutting down abortion clinics all throughout the South, and in particular, ending the right to abortion for women everywhere in this country. All right, that's what it's all about. And Dawn has made a very powerful and inspiring documentary about the struggle of abortion providers and people working in those clinics to keep them open and to make sure that women everywhere have the right to an abortion. You know, just back on the sort of an extension of that, going back to the point about the admitting privileges at hospitals, this is something that people might think, well, what's wrong with that? Right. Of course you should have admitting privileges at hospitals. If something happens there, you're going to have to, you know, you have to send somebody to a hospital. You're going to have to be able to take care of them. And what happens if you're not allowed to go into the hospital? So I think people might think that this is a reasonable, basically, requirement. And what would you say about that?
That's exactly right. You've really kind of hit it on the head there, because what happens is it sounds on its face like it's a reasonable, you know, regulation. But if you think about it, it doesn't really make any sense. You have women who are traveling often because there are so few clinics in so many places in the South and in concentrated areas. You have women who are often traveling 25, 50, 100, 150 miles or more to get to a clinic. If that person had an emergency after they got home, they wouldn't go drive 3 hours and have their doctor who performed the procedure admit them to the emergency room. You go to the emergency room where you are located. So the reality is less than 1% of abortion procedures performed in outpatient clinics require a hospital emergency admission. And if something required a hospital emergency admission, no hospital is going to refuse a patient. So it's not a question of whether the patient's going to be treated. And just like any other emergency, if you had an emergency at your dentist office, your dentist doesn't admit you to the hospital. You go to the emergency room and you're treated and you explain what happened. So it's not, the American Medical Association, the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians all have come out against these regulations as not being medically necessary. And yet these regulations are required for physicians to perform abortions. So that is going to be one of the issues squarely before the Supreme Court. Is that requirement an undue burden on women seeking abortions such that it violates a constitutional right to privacy and right to bodily integrity embodied in the 14th Amendment and so is illegitimate? So
yeah,
it's going to be a really important case.
Yeah, definitely. Now, tell me this. I want to talk a little bit more about the staff, that from the doctors to the staff people in it, because that was one of the most inspiring things in the film, that to see both the camaraderie, but the dedication and the determination that people were not going to allow this to stop them. And it was very, very moving to see this, including the one woman who has kept her clinic open, and even though she hasn't been able to bring patients in because of some violation that they accused her of. I'd like to talk a little bit about this. And one thing I thought, even just to start it, is this thing about like the booklet, the medical warnings, yeah. You know, the did you know booklet.
Did you know?
Yeah, because I thought that captured a certain thing about the sort of the character of the staff, and they're in your face. You're not going to get away with this. Tell people about this. Did you know?
You know, when you're a documentary filmmaker, one of the things you look for is kind of that strength. You know, showing people who are everyday kind of unsung, you know, the word heroes is thrown around too often, but really each of the characters in the film are people who live in the communities, you know, have lived there for either all their lives or for many, many years. And they are not allowing, you know, a hostile kind of conservative religious environment to scare them away. And it was really moving to me to see how much they are from those communities, and they are serving the women in the communities. And I'll tell you, you know, something that happened kind of off camera. A lot of cool stuff happens off camera, which kills us documentary people. But June Ayers, who owns the clinic in Montgomery, Alabama, and she is a 2-time cancer survivor. She's been like on the verge of bankruptcy, you know, multiple times. And it's something we had. We were filming and had kind of a rough day. And I said to her, "Do you ever think about just leaving?" And she looked at me and she goes, "Never." She's like, "I'm not going to leave my ladies." And she looked at me and she said, "You know what? I'm Southern too, and they don't get to decide who a Southerner is or who a strong woman is." And I think for her and for the other clinic providers, it's very important that they be from their communities and that they look their community members in the eyes and say, "I belong here too." And that's, you know, the kind of dedication that keeps people. They also understand very clearly that there are not people waiting in line to open abortion clinics behind them. It's a business that is so hyper-regulated, has so many difficulties existing, that it's not something that people are lining up to go open. So they are really, when we think about the right to choose, the right doesn't mean very much if there aren't any clinics. And these people, men and women, are keeping those clinics open. And there's really just a few of them. So there have been some really fantastic movies about abortion clinics, abortion services. After Tiller is a beautiful, beautiful movie about late-term abortion, about the four remaining late-term abortion people. Mm-hmm. But the abortion access in After Tiller is less than 5% of all the abortions performed in America. So these handful of people, these, you know, three independent clinic owners, are keeping abortion access open for the other 95% of people who are facing that choice. And, you know, I think it was really important to me to show these are Southerners too. These are people who you might not expect, and they're funny, and they're religious, and they're just regular people, but they have this will that I found really compelling. And one of the things I hope to achieve in the film is to show that. Yeah. Show that there's a lot of ways to be strong.
Yeah, definitely. And I thought one of the ways, that's why I was so attracted to this thing of even just giving people a hint about what this Did You Know book it was, because there was a sense of humor behind it, but also deadly serious, because there was a dangerous thing that was being put out in terms of scaring women about what could happen, what might happen. You know, you could have, you know, you could drop dead if I touch you or something, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah, you have, so for June Ayers Clinic, you have, you know, in Mississippi, the informational booklet required, mandated to be published by the state, requires an abortion provider to say that abortion could cause breast cancer. So there's medically inaccurate information, and then all of these scare tactics. You know, we started the film with a young woman who says, "What if I get the pelvic inflammatory disease? Am I going to lose my ability to have children?" And so you have people who are coming in and are terrified about a procedure that is one of the safest outpatient medical procedures that is performed. And so there's a huge disconnect between the amount of attention and the kind of information and the way that it's presented that is given in these state-mandated books. The state requires these books to be handed out. And I think that's also, you know, it's an issue for medicine. I mean, we should be educating people with accurate facts. You can oppose abortion on what your version of morality is, but I find it really objectionable to be bullying and to be giving people medically inaccurate information that causes them unnecessary additional stress over something that is already very stressful. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, "Wouldn't it be fun to have an abortion today?" I don't know anybody, you know, I've seen many, many people over the last 4 years. And so it's really kind of an abusive thing to do to folks it doesn't make them change their minds. It just makes them worry more. Mm-hmm. And I, that makes me really angry.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that came out in your film, too, which I thought is linked to what you're just talking about, is that the more the other side gets away with this kind of bull that they're running out on things, and the intimidation and the actual use of the legal system to actually do away with abortion to the extent they can do it now, and then obviously with the goal of doing away with it once and for all. You know, you think about this, and what actually ends up happening, this was referred to in the film as well, is that actually what ends up happening is self-induced abortions.
That's right.
Are on the rise, and those are what's actually very dangerous, and it's a direct product of this question of banning the right to an abortion in other circumstances.
That's absolutely right. The University of Texas did a study that estimates between 100,000 and 240,000 Texan women, not women across the country, but women in Texas, have attempted to self-abort since more than half of the clinics in the state have been closed. So we're going from a situation where you have medically trained professionals performing a very safe procedure in a regulated environment to closing those facilities, cutting off that access, and women are not any less desperate to end their pregnancies. And so you see people taking, you know, matters into their own hands. And that was the situation pre-Roe v. Wade. And it's a very much a concern that in a lot of states we're kind of going back to that pre-Roe reality.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that whole point there, too, about denying the humanity of the women who are seeking abortions, and the women who aren't seeking abortions but might need them at some point in the future, just should have the right to have it be there. What I really like about the film is that across the board, there's no hesitation, there's no defensiveness about whether or not what abortion is, that it's a much-needed and legitimate medical procedure and essential part of women's health care. This is extremely important. I thought that this came out a lot with Dr. Parker in particular, and he talked about how providing abortions was a matter of his humanity and even more so recognizing the humanity of women. I thought that was an extremely important point that, you know, that the film carried out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's an extraordinary person, and it has been really added a lot to my life to know him. You know, he didn't provide abortions for the first 12 years of his career. He was raised in the South, in Alabama, very poor, in a very religious household. And he, when he went to medical school and became an OBGYN, he, you know, did not perform abortions. And then he saw women dying, women injured, maimed out of, you know, lack of prenatal health care. And he said, I think that this is part of humanity. I provide a medical service that I'm trained to do. And he really hasn't looked back. And I think one of the things I really hope happens as people see the film and talk about it is the stigma around abortion is lessened. 1 in 3 American women will have an abortion before she's 45. That means 33% of our population is undergoing this service. And I definitely saw throughout our screenings at Sundance, one of the unanticipated, really lovely things that happened was people started talking about their experiences and feeling not quite so alone. And I think my goal is that we would talk about this for what it is. It's healthcare, and leave people's morality to people. You know, I can't decide your morality. You don't decide mine. But we can do something that we know is you know, kind of a medically and sometimes, you know, needed or desired procedure. I trust women enough to make decisions about their own lives. I can't make a decision for somebody else, and I don't choose to.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, and I have just two more questions, and this one will be quick here, but maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll answer it lengthily, but my thing here is that, you know, I can't help, I do think this, when I think about the right to an abortion and the need for women to have free, open access to getting an abortion, to any kind of health care that they need, and I think about this, if you're denying that to a woman, you're actually denying her any control over her body. And that, to me, is the equivalent to, or it's a form of enslavement. It's a form of slavery. If you're not allowed to actually control your body, what the hell is it that you are in society? You know,
that's right. What can you control? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most like profound and fundamentally important decisions for any woman and for her partner, for her family, is whether and when to become a parent. And to force somebody into that situation, and, you know, I think it's not extreme to think back to that 13-year-old you know, who's gang raped, should she be forced to bear a child? You know, anyone who's had a child knows that is it's a life-altering moment. And it seems to me just to be completely without question that that's somebody's right to decide for themselves. So it's just hard to imagine how anyone could think it's not.
Mm-hmm. All right, one last question, Dawn. So what's up with the film now? What's going to happen with this?
We came kind of roaring out of Sundance, and we were so thrilled and gratified by the reception. And we are now taking the film around to film festivals and also to community screenings. So if people visit trapdocumentary.com, you can arrange for a screening in your local community. And then we are opening theatrically in theaters in selected cities March 4th, and then continuing to open in additional cities March 11th. So we're trying to get as many screenings as possible in order to have as much conversation as possible. We're in an election year where this should be a big topic of discussion, access to abortion. And on March 2nd, the Supreme Court will hear a challenge to the TRAP laws. So the title of the film comes from Trapped, comes from TRAP laws. So the Supreme Court will hear an argument. It will be argued by the Center for Reproductive Rights, and a decision on whether these laws that have closed, you know, so many clinics across the country will be able to stand is expected in June. So between now and June, we are trying to have as many screenings as possible in as many communities as possible. So if people care about these issues, we hope they will come out, support those screenings, and tell people this is an issue that matters to you.
Mm-hmm. So it's trappeddocumentary.com that people should go to?
Yes.
Okay, great. Dawn Porter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. And we'll stay in touch just so I can keep up on what's going on and chip in, okay?
Thank you.
All right, Dawn. Take care now.
Okay.
Bye. All right. We've just been talking with Dawn Porter, the director of the film Trapped, and we've been talking about the fight to keep abortion clinics and abortion services open and available, not only in the South, but everywhere across the country, and all the attempts to crush that. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with Sansara Taylor. Nina Simone with I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. We're going to go into the excerpt of the interview I did with Sansara Taylor back in January. Remember now, you can hear the entire interview at my website, which is at themichaelslateshow.com. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show today Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, Revcom.us, and an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you too. Let's talk about this. I was just saying the anniversary of Roe v. Wade decision is coming up. And as usual, there's all kinds of anti-abortion fanatics and fascists mobilizing against the right to an abortion. There's a certain sense it's clear that the anti-abortion fascists are clear on what's at stake here. But I'm not so sure it's at the same level of clarity on the part of the people who think that abortion is an essential right that women must have. So let's start off with why is it important that people don't just sort of ho-hum this upcoming thing around Roe v. Wade, that people actually get into it and take this up and fight it out?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I think people know that there have been some anti-abortion laws passed. They know that maybe there's been some acts of violence here and there against abortion clinics. But really, I think that people have no real idea the scale and the scope of an emergency facing abortion rights. It's an intense and extreme emergency, and it's a largely invisible emergency. It's one that's felt by millions and millions of women, huge numbers of women. People should know this country is seeing an escalation because there have been so many abortion clinics forced to close because of medically unnecessary fascist anti-woman laws. There have been 100,000 women in Texas alone have self-induced abortions, attempted to induce their own abortions because they can't access a clinic. The Planned Parenthood, as you cited in Colorado, that was shot up, held hostage. And of course, the media treated it like it was just another instance of gun violence. This was anti-abortion terrorism. There are doctors being stalked across this country. Half the clinics in the country have people in the clinics who've experienced targeted harassment and stalking and terrorism. That means they've been followed home. Their children have been harassed at school. They've been hunted. They've been sent hate mail to their parents. The nursing homes have been harassed. This is targeted, widespread terrorism against abortion providers. It's doubled in the last 4 years, the rate at which that's happening. It's an abortion rights emergency. It's the young woman, Anna Yoka, who's in Tennessee. Tennessee is a state where you have a 48-hour waiting period. It's one of many states with a waiting period. So you don't have to just go to the clinic once to get an abortion. You have to make the trip more than once. You have to go. You have to wait 2 days. You have to go again. You have to take the time off of work twice. You have to have the money to travel because so many clinics are closed down. A lot of women have to travel great distances. If you have another child, you have to find childcare. If you're in an abusive marriage, you have to, or a relationship, you have to figure out how to get out of the house. You have to come up with the money to make the trip. And you have to make the trip twice. There's all kinds of hurdles and restrictions. So Anna Yucca was one of many people in this country who attempted to self-induce. She allegedly attempted to self-induce an abortion. This was recently. She used a coat hanger. This is not 40 years ago. This is not 60 years ago before Roe v. Wade. She used a coat hanger and ended up bleeding profusely, was scared for her life and went to the hospital. And instead of being treated like a woman who needed help terminating an unwanted pregnancy and should have every right to do so, the hospital intervened and removed the fetus and put it on life support and forced Anna Yoka to become a mother against her will, first of all. Then they turn her over to the state and they get the police and the state involved. Anna Yoka has been charged with first-degree attempted murder. She's sitting in prison. She's sitting in jail. She is somebody who was almost murdered by the state and all the anti-abortion laws that have been passed, but instead she is being charged with murder. And so Anna Yoka, she represents the lives of millions of women, and she's being made an example of, frankly. A legal precedent is being set, but an example. It's kind of like an honor killing. You kill one woman in a very public way, and you send a chill to every other woman. If you go to the hospital, if you can't find help to get a safe, legal abortion, and you take matters into your own hands, you better not show up at the hospital, even if you're bleeding to death, because you could end up in jail. This is what's being done right now. And I think that the quote from Bob Avakian is very germane, because he makes the point, unbelievable as it may seem, there are still people who want to remove from women the right to decide for themselves whether and when they will have a child. They want to force women to have children against their will, and it is a form of enslaving women. Of enslaving women to the dictates of a male supremacist patriarchal system in society. It's a form of forcing women into a subordinate place to foreclose their lives, to have children against their will, to make their entire lives contorted and deformed. Look, having a child, if you want to have a child, can be wonderful. But if you don't want one, you're having your life foreclosed and deformed and funneled into being a breeder against your will. And in the context of a male supremacist, male-dominated society where and you're treated with disrespect, where you don't have as many options, where the burden lands on the woman by herself with tremendous shame and very few resources. And I think this is the objective. This is the objective of the anti-abortion movement.
Let me ask you this, because that's an extremely important point and what you've just been saying. Because, look, for a lot of people, there's the thing where people will say, okay, you know, yeah, but these are a handful of fanatics out there. What does this have to do with the whole society? There's a lot more of us rational thinking, kind-hearted, good-willed people who are saying, no, we're not going to allow women to be pushed into virtual slavery. At the same time, it's sort of like people are looking at it as it's still really – I mean, that's treating it as it's some kind of like wacky leftover from a bygone era or an embarrassing blemish on what pretty much is an overall cool situation for women today. After all, we're not forcing them – to be one of a harem of nine wives and the rest of this stuff, and they have no rights at all. Let's talk about that, because it's much heavier than I think what people initially and spontaneously just say, yeah, okay, it's important what you're saying, but it's not all that.
Yeah, I think I like the way you asked. Even people say, well, we wouldn't allow that. Well, first of all, wake up. You are allowing it. It is happening. I didn't make up the story I just told. I didn't make up the Planned Parenthood shooting or the stalking that's going on or the terrorism against all these other doctors. These are not minor phenomena. But they're also not isolated. I think you're right. And this is the way it gets portrayed in the mainstream bourgeois ruling class media, and the way it gets portrayed by the Democrats, too, constantly. We're making progress for women. Women have basically achieved their equality. There's a few leftover things. There's these out-of-touch Republicans. They're trying to take women's rights away, but they're out of touch. First of all, they're succeeding, first of all. But second of all, it's not the case that women are achieving all-around emancipation except for a few leftovers who are going for abortion rights. We live in a society where women are, they're stalked, they're beaten, they're raped at phenomenal levels, where it's more dangerous for a woman to be in her own home or a young girl to be in her own home than it is to be on the street, where domestic abuse is just rampant, where women are still, look, the culture, the mainstream culture, you click on the radio. I can say the word bitches on the air. There's all kinds of words I can't say, but I can say bitches. You could say hoes. You can play it in the music. You can bop your head to it. Kids are learning these words and learning to see women as such before they even know what they mean. Girls are learning this. You have the whole culture is saturated with violent, degrading, cruel pornography that's training boys and men to see the degradation and torture of women as sexually titillating. And that's coloring and shaping the way real men treat real women. And it's not a, these are not minor phenomena. These are major parts. They're cornerstones of the culture. And it goes along with the brutality. It goes along with the way that women are trafficked around the world, all over the world, including into this country and including girls in this country being pimped out at the age 12, 13 years old, and there being men who will purchase them. And not a, again, not a minor phenomenon, a major phenomenon. So it's all that. And then it's just the way that girls are, girls and women are bombarded with the message that their value is derived from being somehow a prized sex object or the smartest or the sexiest or the best catch for a man. And so their value, they starve themselves, they learn to hate themselves, they learn to play dumb, they learn to cut themselves. There's all kinds of ways that they internalize the worthlessness that this society tells them that they aren't worth anything unless they are a sex object or a breeder or somehow desired by men. And this is the world we live in. And it has a body count, and it has a psychic toll, and it has a trauma toll, and it affects every woman, and including the young women. I'll just say, including the women, young women and otherwise, who are told they've made it. They go to college. They have a career. They have a future. They're told you can achieve, too. You could be just as cutthroat and just as top dog as a man, which itself has problems. But at the same time, you still have to be that sexual performer. You still have to be the perfect household keeper. You still have to be. It's you're told you can have it all, but really what you're being told is now you have to conform to every sexual standard, every standard of what women, a subordinated woman is supposed to be. You're supposed to conform to all of them at once. We don't live in a liberated society. This is a patriarchal, male-dominated society, and we need a revolution. It's one of the many reasons, the level of degradation and disrespect and harm caused to women is one of the many reasons, but it's reason enough by itself that this whole society, this whole system needs to be done away with, because it's 43 years after Roe v. Wade, and women are being killed to go get abortions. They're being imprisoned for that. We're going backwards. We need a revolution. We need a different society, a different world.
Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Now, Sansara, what you're laying out, and that point about particularly this point about we need a revolution, I mean, when you think about this, even for people who recognize a substantial part of what you've been laying out about the situation of women, there is this point that's really, really just, I think, weighs heavily on people. You look at this and it's like, well, what the hell can we do about it? You know, there's limited room to move. There's, you know, I know people look at this and they say, I do everything I can. You're advocating, you just said revolution is what's necessary for this. And I don't think that's something that people go, oh, yeah. I think we really got to get into and explain some of that. Why is revolution necessary and what? What are you talking about here?
By revolution, people need to look at RevCom.us. They need to go and check out the leadership of Bob Avakian. He's somebody who has been fighting for revolution, leading a revolutionary struggle in this country, but also creating a new foundation, a new theoretical framework for revolution and the emancipation of humanity all over the world, summing up previous revolutions and what has been accomplished and what can be accomplished. But one of the things he really hammers at is that, and he's correct in this, and this is at the foundation of a lot of the problems that then he's put himself to, is that he's recognized that as long as you have the economic system and the culture and the structures and the relations among people that flow from and are enforced by capitalism, imperialism, and the state that governs that and the laws that enforce it and the police that enforce it and the culture that reinforces it, as long as you have that, you can fight, you can resist, you can make some changes, but you will never get free. There'll be changes on a spectrum, and they'll be important, but they keep getting undermined, and we see that. We see that everything the 60s accomplished is being cut back and then some, you know, reversed and with revenge involved. And he's made the point, you need to clear it away. You need to bring the system down, and you need to build a new revolutionary state power. You need to build a socialist state heading towards a communist world, and that that is materially possible. And it's much more realistic. It's much more realistic than reforming the system to be something that it can't be. And if that's true, which it is, then you need to put yourself to the problems involved in making that kind of revolution. And how do we prepare people? How do we prepare the grounds? How do we bring forward and hasten the development of a situation where millions can be led to go all out to fight to bring this system down and build a new society and a new state? How would such a struggle be won? And how? What would a new society and new state power look like? And this is something Bob Avakian has taken responsibility for. And the scope of all of what that means, it goes beyond what you and I can get into, and even in a short interview, but it's at revcom.us, and BA has done the work, including leading and developing a constitution for the new Socialist Republic of North America that lays out how we could do, starting day one, how we could actually build an economy and a state and a culture where, first of all, among other things, women have access, unstigmatized, unrestricted access to birth control and abortion so that they can actually control for themselves when and whether they're going to have children, so they can be full human beings and viewed as such, where things like the rampant, violent, degrading, dehumanizing pornography, that's not a cornerstone of the culture. That's going to be shut down, not through puritanism, not through suppressing all expressions of sex. And in fact, we're going to take on religion too, and all the social mores and stigma and shame on women's bodies and sexuality that comes with that. We're going to take on all of that so that women will be viewed as full human beings, including in the sexual realm and sexual liberation, but also including every other realm that women are locked out of in this society. And those are just some of the dimensions in the education system, in the culture, and in the laws that will be given the backing of the state. In the Constitution, you go through, people will have the right to eat. We're not going to degrade and despoil the environment. The police will not be marauding and terrorizing and brutalizing poor and oppressed people. We'll be overcoming white supremacy and oppression. So these are all, you know, they're laid out in great detail. And a lot of work was done here. And this is, you can find it at revcom.us, but this is real. And BA, Bob Avakian, has been leading this. And this is real. And this is something everybody, if you really want to end slavery in every form, if you want a different world, you have to get into this leadership. You have to actually, if we don't make a revolution, humanity will continue to be ground up the way it is today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you've made this point about we need to make a revolution. Now, this is sort of where I think actually we need to sort of hook up with the other thing too, because, okay, you're saying we need to have this revolution. What are you also saying? And then you're also saying, and we need to fight this assault on women, this stuff around Roe v. Wade and all the other ways that the assault on women comes down, but especially in relation to the abortion rights and the assault on Roe v. Wade. What's the connection there? I mean, you're talking about to people, you're saying, look, really, we need a revolution if we're ever going to resolve any of this. And I think people are going to say, okay, well, then what about – why is it so important to take this other stuff up?
Well, I think revolution, like I said before, it's not a passive affair. We're not sitting back saying, well, we don't want to get our hands dirty with the messiness of this distasteful system, so we'll wait for the revolution. No, this system is a horror. It's a mess. It's a nightmare for humanity, all parts of its functioning. We need a revolution. We need a different system. And to get there, people need to fight back today. We need to get into the theory and the leadership. We need to get organized for a revolution, and we need to fight the power on that foundation and unite with people coming from whatever perspective you're coming from. If you recognize that it's in the DNA of this system of capitalism and imperialism for women to be treated as less than fully human, to be oppressed and degraded and controlled through the patriarchal family, to be denied their basic reproductive rights, to be shamed and stigmatized for their sexuality and their sexual desires, if you recognize that that is built into the foundation of this system, then you recognize even more than anybody why you can't rely on this system to beat back these attacks, and you have to rely on the people themselves to stand up and fight against it. And right now there are millions and millions of people, most of them are not aware of it, because the emergency facing abortion is so invisible. It is so unspoken. It is so covered over. It is so played down, including by the very people that people have been trained to look to protect them on this front. The Democratic Party and other so-called leaders in the so-called women's movement are playing this emergency down so people don't know. But the fact is, millions and millions of people are going to be and are already being affected by this assault on abortion rights. And those are people who can be aroused and awakened to the need to stand up and fight back against this, but only if we tell them the truth, that like the quote from Bob Avakian that you began with, the fight over abortion has never been about babies. It's about controlling women. And if people understand what's at stake and we get out there with the truth that women are not incubators, women are not breeders, fetuses are not babies, abortion is not murder, and this needs to be resisted, we can actually lead people, hundreds, thousands, and ultimately millions, to stand up and fight back against this and to change ourselves to beat back these attacks and actually create much more favorable conditions for an actual revolution. So those things are of a piece.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things, and right now, okay, look, you've opened up a whole lot of other issues and arguments and all this other stuff, objections to what you put forward, all this kind of stuff. It's sort of like you are saying, I mean, this is one of the things, I know somebody was asking me this the other day. They kind of said, all right, well, look, you're talking about, you're saying that, well, none of this stuff around the oppression of women, for instance, can be resolved under capitalism. And yet at the same time, you're telling me to fight against this so that we can push back some of the attacks. And they were saying, are you using this as a game to get me into the revolution scene? Or is it real that you can, that there's both a necessity and a possibility of pushing some things back, but it's not going to solve the problem? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's no game involved in revolution. And there's no trick going on. I think we should be very honest with people. It's going to take a revolution to end patriarchy. It's going to take a communist revolution. It's going to take the kind of revolution that Bob Avakian has re-envisioned, that communism. Because he's re-envisioned communism, including in significant dimension in how it understands and relates to and takes up the fight for women's liberation as a cornerstone and a driving force, actually, in the emancipation of all humanity. And that's the truth. And if you care about liberation, you have to do the work. You have to get into what Bob Avakian has done on this question. He wrote a pamphlet, a compendium was put together that pulls together some of his many writings on the oppression and liberation of women, called Bob Avakian on the Liberation of Women and the Emancipation of Humanity. And people should read it. People should read the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic. People should get into what he's done and evaluate, is this true or not true? Is there any other way to solve these problems? And the solutions that Bob Avakian has fought for and brought forward and the active leadership he's giving to the movement for revolution, if this is taken up and fought for, where will it lead? And people should get into that. At the same time, we do need to fight. And Avakian has stressed this as well, and he's given a lot of leadership. Frankly, I've been fighting, I've been a leader in the fight for abortion rights for two decades now. All of that has been guided by and led by the active and ongoing leadership of Avakian that he's been providing. So we've been fighting very actively on this. But I think this thing, it's a real emergency. We're not making that up either. Google Anna Yucca. Google the 100,000 people who self-induced in Texas. Google the fact that every single week and a half in this country, an abortion clinic is forced to close. And then think about what it means for women to experience a late period, to start to get worried that their period is not coming, that they may be pregnant, and the whole world comes crashing down on them. And they're told there's nobody they can talk to because they've done something wrong. They're 15 years old and they think they're committing a sin, and their mother and their grandmother and their priest, all they're afraid to tell them, or if they tell them, they're going to make the girl have a child. Think about what it means for millions of women who are heaped with this stigma and shame, whose lives are foreclosed, and who then, even if they find their way through that and they make it to a clinic, or they try to go to a clinic, they have all these obstacles. They have people hurling insults and screaming at them on the way into the clinics. They have people blocking their access, making it so that they have to travel too far or raise too much money. Think about the reality of that and ask yourself, does this need to be fought or should this be accepted? Mm-hmm. And right now it needs to be fought. It needs to be fought by everybody. Everybody who cares about this should get into the revolution. But as you do, and wherever you're at in that, this needs to be fought now. And ask yourself this. When in the history of this country was any advance made for the oppressed, whether it be Black people during the civil rights struggle or the Black liberation struggle, whether it be women in the way that the right to abortion was won in the first place, whether it be any other section of oppressed people, those who wanted to stand up against the wars for empire that this country has waged, when has anything been accomplished without people stepping out of their comfort zone and going into the streets and changing the way others think by putting themselves on the line and changing the course of history? And we're not making this up. This is an emergency, and it needs to be fought, and there's no other way it's going to be changed. There's nobody in power who's going to stop it for you. They have no interest in it, and their track record proves it. And so you have to get out, and you have to be part of doing the work to resist this.
All right. That was Sansara Taylor, revolutionary communist writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. You can hear the entire interview at themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, it's my website, themichaelslateshow.com, and the entire interview will be posted up there. So check that out. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my guests, Dawn Porter and Sansara Taylor, and all the people who worked on the show. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, intern, Alex Brenner, and engineer, Teddy Robinson. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again now, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.